RadioInfluence.com.
Amazing near-death experiences. Plato. Greek philosopher and mathematician Plato wrote about one of the earliest examples of a near-death experience. In the conclusion of Republic, Plato wrote of a soldier named Air who was killed in battle. Air's body sat for several days but did not decompose like the other fallen men. When his body was about to be burned on a funeral pyre, Air regained consciousness. He told amazed witnesses of an afterlife and reincarnation. He gave accounts of planets and worlds that no one had ever witnessed. Air's story remains one of the first recorded accounts of an amazing near-death experience. Mellon Thomas Benedict. In 1982, artist Mellon Thomas Benedict died of terminal cancer. While he was traveling toward the light, Benedict decided he had questions and wanted to see things first. In an amazing near-death experience, he recalled flying through the solar system, leaving this galaxy and traveling to other worlds that had other life. His journey reportedly took him to far-off worlds and even past the Big Bang into the void of nothingness. Benedict awoke an hour and a half later after he had died. Later tests showed that his cancer had gone into what the doctors called spontaneous remission. Susanna O'Murray. When she was 11 years old, Susanna O'Murray ran out into the road right after a speeding car was coming through. The car struck Susanna and sent her flying into the air. She later stated that while she was up in the air, everything went into slow motion. O'Murray could look down at the car below and noticed a crowd of people standing around watching. Within the group were her two grandmothers, both of whom had been long dead. The two were yelling at Susanna, telling her she couldn't join them yet. With that, everything sped right back up and she hit the hood of the car in the road, ending up relatively unharmed. Don Piper. In 1989, Don Piper was in the car that hit a transport truck head-on. Declared dead by paramedics, Piper was without a pulse for 90 minutes. While he was dead, he experienced music and smells which were very pleasing. He also met with his grandfather and several other long-deceased acquaintances in front of a very large gate. The whole experience was deemed rather pleasant. The meeting was cut short when Piper began to regain consciousness. His return to life surprised many, including the people who had stopped to pray near his body at the scene of the horrific accident. Amanda Cable. In September 2003, Amanda Cable slipped into unconsciousness after her heart stopped in the hospital. Cable left her body and was eventually greeted by the figure of her daughter, Ruby, wearing a school uniform with her hair up in bunches. Ruby urged her mom down a white tunnel to a gate. After passing through the gate, Ruby slammed the doors behind her mother. When Cable regained consciousness, she was greeted at her bedside by her husband. He had brought a picture of Ruby from the first day of school, which Amanda had missed because she was in the hospital. In the picture, Ruby was wearing a school uniform and had her hair up in bunches, a style she had never before worn. George Rodonea. In 1976, George Rodonea was pronounced dead after being struck by a car. His body was taken to the morgue where it sat for 3 days. When doctors began to cut Rodonea's body to undertake an official autopsy, he regained consciousness to the shock of everyone. Rodonea's shocking recovery was matched by the stories he had while he was dead. During his experience, he relived parts of his life and met with various people. With the ability to travel anywhere in time and space, Rodonea said he was able to meet historical figures and travel back in time to eras such as the Roman Empire. Dr. Mary Neal. In 1999, Dr. Mary Neal was kayaking when her craft turned over. Pinned underwater, Neal was without air for up to 25 minutes before help arrived. In her unconscious state, she endured a near-death experience which told of the future. In this instance, however, it was a future she probably didn't want to know. While she was dead, Neal was informed that her 9-year-old son would die. No information concerning the specifics of his death were given. However, the prophecy came true 10 years later when Neal's now 19-year-old son was killed in a car accident. Paul Icke. When he was just 3 years old, Paul Icke fell through the ice of a pond. Pulled from the pond by rescuers, Paul was considered clinically dead because he had no pulse for 3 hours. After considerable work by doctors, Paul's heart started again and the little boy lived to tell an interesting story. Paul claimed he had been floating around in the sky before arriving at a gate. He approached the gate and tried to enter but was turned away by a figure who said to be his late grandmother. As she turned him away from the entrance, her parting message was that Paul's parents were waiting for him. Anita Moriani. In 2006, Anita Moriani's fight with terminal cancer seemed to be at an end when she slipped into a coma. As her organs shut down and her body swelled, Anita later reported that she was listening to conversations between doctors and her husband far away from her hospital room. She also saw a vision of her brother traveling on a plane to see her. Both events were later confirmed, but Anita could not have known about them at the time. Allegedly given the choice to live or die, Anita came back to full consciousness and underwent a miraculous recovery whereby her cancer regressed to the point that doctors could find no trace of it. Colton Burpo. When 3-year-old Colton was laying on the hospital surgery table with a burst appendix, doctors feared for the worst. Amazingly, 2 hours later, Colton was out of surgery with some amazing stories to tell. He told his parents that he had met a little girl who was his sister. In fact, Colton's mother had suffered a miscarriage while carrying what would have been a daughter, but they had never told their son about this. He also told them of a conversation he had with a man named Pop. Colton was later able to identify the man in family photos as his paternal grandfather who had died years earlier.
Let me tell you why you're here.
You have 210 stories.
What two?
Office buildings.
We just witnessed some kind of...
You don't find a desk.
Secondary.
You don't find a chair.
Follow-up explosion on the World Trade Center.
You don't find a telephone.
Some kind of explosion. A lot of smoke come out of the top.
110 stories high. They are no longer there.
The building collapsed to dust.
To dust. To dust. To dust. To dust. To dust. This is your last chance.
I would ask.
After this, there is no turning back.
Once all the facts are out.
You take the blue pill.
For your understanding.
The story ends.
And for your forgiveness.
You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want.
Media is the...
You take the red
nervous
pill.
System of a democracy.
You stay in Wonderland.
If it's not functioning well, the democracy can't function.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
The democracy red can't
pill.
Function.
The red pill.
Take the red pill.
You have to let it all go.
Take the red pill.
Fear.
Doubt. WhatReallyHappened.com.
You just believe.
WTC7.net.
Free your mind.
Take the red pill.
Like a rabbit hunting license. I mean, I spend that much of my time like following trails that sometimes you're never going to get to the end of it, and then there's a left turn and a right turn and you're headed in another direction and you have to rethink something. You have to say, I was wrong about this, but I'm rethinking that. It can be taxing, it can be tiring, but you've got to be willing to ask those questions. And if you're not, you're listening to the wrong show. I think American Idol's on somewhere. You should go check it out. I hear there's a really good singer there. Welcome to Dangerous Conversation. I'm your semi-humble host, Scott Ledger. Good to talk to you. Tonight, no politics, no ISIS, no war, no violence. In fact, as I became a talk show host about 10 years ago, I started to realize that life is full of so many mysteries. Why would anybody want to just talk about one thing or two things? It's just not me. It's not my DNA. It's the asking questions part is, but the person that is always going to be curious. I've been told I'm a sponge. I've been told, you know a little bit about a lot of things. I've been told a lot of things, except I absolutely believe everything you say all the time. Good. Thank God you don't. We don't want that. And tonight, like I said, when I started doing talk radio, 2005. I started to be able to have that medium to ask a question or two about things that I was curious about, as well as things I not only knew a little bit about, but I started looking for that feedback from people, because when you're on an island and you are sitting there and you have an opinion about something, you don't seek validation from other people, but you do seek, like, am I the only one thinking this? How come I feel so isolated and alone when it comes to this topic or these topics? And that's when I started to realize that my personal journey, my spiritual journey, my professional journey were all intersecting. And the feedback I got by doing my first talk show was actually called Outside the Box. It was on an AM station that nobody could hear. It was on Sunday nights. It was up against football. And I think I only did 13 of them. I never took a phone call. I never booked a guest. It was simply about me trying to get better at hopefully what I do, communicate thoughts, ideas, and concepts. So tonight, as the intro stated, we're going to talk about the near-death experience. Now, just so you get a little back history for me, in, I want to say, 98 or 99, my then wife at the time, Brooke, had brought me a coffee table book called Death. It was, I mean, yeah, it was a cheerful idea. Here's a book on death, honey. It was illustrated. It was literally like the big shiny kind of vinyl pages. You know, it was a coffee table book. And I read it in a day. Though I will admit it had big pictures. It had big pictures, like sometimes on one page. And as I read this book, I went back in time about 5,000 years ago, and I realized that the Egyptians were fascinated by what was across the Great River. You know, there was always a divide or a veil or a place that we were and the spirit world or, you know, whatever reference you want to make to it was on the other side. And they were so curious about it. Remember, they had slaves. Imagine being an Egyptian slave and you get called into the queen and they put you in a tomb. And they seal it, and they cut off your oxygen, and they time it out. I don't know whether they have, like, egg timers back then. How do they keep time? They literally would kill people, and some of them died, and some of them were resuscitated because they were so curious as to what these slaves would say as they, quote, came back, unquote. Imagine being there, and they seal the tomb, and you're in there, and you suffocate, and you die, and they're counting 1,000, 2,000, 10 Mississippi, 11 Mississippi. And the guy goes, okay, open it up. Let's see if he's alive. And some of the people came back or were resuscitated, and they started describing seeing themselves in the tomb, the outside of the OBE. It's called the out-of-body experience. And throughout time, including you heard the early reference to Plato there, many people have been curious as to many. Who isn't curious about what happens when you die? It is the final frontier. Nothing personal, Mr. Spock. Nothing personal, James T. Kirk. Nothing personal, but guess what? The ultimate mystery is death. The ultimate, and by the way, everything we're going to talk about tonight is not proof of anything. I'm not a preacher. I'm not here to tell you what God is or God isn't. I will explain to you and I think I'll do this in the opening statement. Having been raised Roman Catholic and the concepts of hell and punishment and all these things, I started to see and read about the near-death experience. As you move through that book, I discovered a man named Raymond Moody. Now, in the 70s is really where the defibrillator came in. That's really when we started to bring cardiac arrest patients back from that void, shocking them back, many being clear, Ringer's lactate, give me an IV of D5W. You know, and we're going to hear from quite a few near-death experiencers, and we're going to hear from some doctors that have done some research, and we're going to hear from a couple of doctors, one doctor specifically, his name is Evan Alexander, who's a neurosurgeon, who was an atheist, who actually had his own NDE. We'll hear from a woman named Pam Reynolds, whose brain was brought to zero for a couple hours. She had an aneurysm in the middle of her brain. We're going to hear from a woman named, I think it's Vicky Noritek, blind since birth, born blind. Now, if you're born blind, how can you start describing things? How can you tell doctors what was happening in that operating room? So on and so on and so forth. And I've got so much audio to get to. This show has definitely got to go 3 hours because I have almost a full hour of audio. I don't know if I'm even going to have time to play a song tonight. Maybe I will, maybe I won't. I to be honest with you, you know, normally we do that. There will definitely not be a Carlin's Corner tonight. And the reason this is so, what's the right word here? Important to me is because when I started to consume Raymond Moody's book called Life After Life, I actually have a hard copy, second edition print of it. He's the man who coined the phrase near-death experience. So think about this. We've been around for, you know, somewhere between either 250,000 to 200,000 years. Most of written history is, you know, from cave etchings to modern day science. We're looking at about 10,000 years. And here we are only a couple of decades ago where we're starting to be able to explore with groups like IANS, I-A-N-D-S, that's the International Association of Near-Death Studies, where we're actually doing the scientific research and the many interviews and the many testimonies. And we got a couple of good skeptics, too, we'll hear from. Because skepticism is a very, very important part of the process. That some of these stories are fascinating. Fascinating doesn't even give it justice. We're all going to die. I'm not here to cheer you up on this one. It's just the realism. We're all going to end the physical journey if consciousness can transcend or does transcend, and it is not part of your brain. Your brain is simply the receiver of a radio transmission. Niels Harrison says, looking for consciousness in the brain is like looking into a radio for the announcer. Many people, quantum mechanics and so on and so forth, are starting to explore. And that's why I'm such a big fan of this, because I think this is where science meets spirituality. I think this is the crossroads. And I think I've said this in many of my shows I've done. Of all the knowledge in the world of energy sources, and it doesn't matter, what is more important in mankind's knowledge than is there a continuation of you, your consciousness? Some people use the word soul. I try not to use the word God and soul too much because religion has co-opted that. And suddenly, the moment you use those words, suddenly people think you are religious or you follow a organized religion. And I don't. But I also see a little truth in some of it here and there. I see some beauty in it. I see some poetry in it. I see fables in it. And I see storytelling in it. But at the end of the day, after all the arguments, after all the different, you know, guess what? What happens to mankind if we could somehow prove without a shadow of a doubt that you will continue after your body is done operating? And when I mean you, I mean your essence, your consciousness, your soul, all those words. What if it's true? Now think of how that relates to the fear of death and how we're controlled by our fear and how everything that relates in our world is about, oh, the boogeyman's going to get you, ISIS is going to get you, Al-Qaeda is going to get you, the communists are going to get you, and you're going to die, and they're going to kill you. What if our fear of death as a species became far less dramatic or far less limited in our concept of death is it? Here, it's over. That's nothing happens. What if? You know me. If you listen to this show and you know me, you know that of all the things I've ever talked about, this is the holy grail of knowledge. I mean, you can have Tesla free energy while you're alive, and you can have the quantum mechanics of string theory and the quantum field while you're alive. But frankly, none of that's going to mean shit while you're on your deathbed. None of it. What will mean something is you don't have fear of death anymore. Because when you hear the stories from these people tonight, and they've lost their fear of death, does it prove there's life after death? No. But wouldn't you love to have that? Wouldn't you love to be that person that goes, no, I don't fear death. I want to live my life until it's over, if it ends tomorrow, if it ends another 30 years. But at the end, I know. That's a big word. Two phrases, I'm sorry, two words. I know that's not the end of me. You don't think that's not just life-changing on an individual basis? Can you imagine what that would do to mankind? How we could not be ruled by our fear of death? And damnation and punishment and all these things we've been fed over 5,000-10,000 years? Well, now modern science is looking into it. And many doctors, Dr. Raymond Moody, I've already mentioned, he kind of kicked it off. I read that coffee table book. And then I went out and got Raymond Moody's book. And then I found Melvin Morse, Dr. Melvin Morse. Now, Dr. Melvin Morse, complete skeptic, I don't want to speak for him, atheist, whatever, the brain dies, you die, your body dies, you die. He started interviewing children. And the reason he did was adults are, if you've spent 40 years in a religion and you die and you say, hey, I saw Jesus or Buddha or Krishna or Muhammad or whatever. Well, when you talk to a three-year-old, they haven't been indoctrinated into that thinking yet. And their stories were a little bit more about candy castles and wizards because they had played a video game. In other words, the human response to the NDE is individual specific to that, because when they use that story to describe their journey or their trip or whatever, that each one of these, and that's what fascinates me about the NDEs, no two stories are the same. They can be similar. And we'll get to some of the things that happen in NDEs on a percentage basis, but no two stories are exactly the same because you are specific individual to your experience. So I read Melvin Morse, a couple books he did. Then I found Dr. Kenneth Ring. He's out of UConn, University of Connecticut. And he actually teaches a class on NDE, and he's been doing it for, let me see. When I read his book, Lessons from the Light, that was 1990, maybe? I'm sorry, 1999, somewhere around there, maybe 2000. He started to just basically gather a bunch of stories. Tell me about your story. Tell me about your story. And he started to say, wow, in this person's NDE, they had a life review. In this person's NDE, they saw loved ones or people that had passed on. In this one's NDE, they came back and they had no fear of death. In this one's NDE, they came back and had some paranormal gifts. Now, tell me, of all the things you think you know or don't know or are curious about or Google or what could be more important than that final frontier? And this is why I've always been a fan of this research. And as these stories started to compile and the internet started to get into YouTube and videos and testimonies, I started to watch them almost at an addictive rate for about a year, where I'd watch 10 stories. Now, we can't play all of those. Just all you have to do is go to Google or YouTube and type the letters NDE in and watch what happens. What I did notice was Christianity or Catholicism, which had preached about a devil or preached about a hell, started to feel the backlash of the NDE years, New Agey feel, where this concept of God wasn't what they were told God was. It wasn't about burning in hell. So I found over probably from about 2001 to 2004 that the Christian community, all different aspects of Christianity, had started to try to co-opt the NDE and use it to prove they were right. They started to look for the negative, what they call the hellish NDE. About 10% of people have hellish NDEs. Pure darkness, pure fear. So there was a battle going on between the pure science of doctors' research, the New Age movement, and the traditional organized religions where they were all starting to fight for the concept of what happens after you die. So if you Google it, NDEs, and you should, go watch a couple someday. We got quite a bit of audio tonight, so we'll hear from... Actually, we're going to play some audio pretty much nonstop. See, here it is almost 8:30 Eastern already, and I've got a lot to get to, and I want to do a little stop and start with some of this audio, but some of this I might just play nonstop for 5 minutes, then maybe come in with a couple of thoughts that I'll jot down on paper. Again, this is not to prove anything. This cannot be proven. But when you start to realize that 600 people a day in this country are reporting some type of near-death experience or out-of-body experience, that over 8 million people in Raymond Moody's time in the 70s, 8 million people had talked about a near-death experience. You can't ignore this. You can't ignore that amount of data. You have to start at least giving it respect. It doesn't mean you have to believe it. You know me. I'm no preacher. World doesn't need any more preachers. You want another preacher? Listen to the wrong show. I'll never tell you what God is. Now, maybe a little towards the end of the show, I will probably tell you why I believe what I believe. But I don't want to do that yet. Because what I believe and what I've been led to understand might be the truth has allowed me an amazing new open-minded concept of what this God thing might be. What happens if your brain activity has been dead, that the blood's been pumped out of your brain, that your body temperature's been brought down to 80 degrees and your heart's been stopped because they need to go all the way inside, deep inside your brain to seal up an aneurysm? Well, her name is Pam Reynolds. Now, she's no longer with us. She actually died of a heart attack a while ago. Irony. But again, you'll hear from her. Dr. Jeffrey Long, Dr. Morris Rawlings, Dr. Tony Lawrence, Dr. James Winery, and the aforementioned Moody, Morrison, Ring are just some of the people that are starting to compile data, compile testimonies. And by the way, my windows are open. It's so gorgeous here in Florida. So if you hear like a car horn or a car drive by, hear it out on the Ledge Studios, it's because it's gorgeous here in Florida right now. There you go. See? Normally I have the windows closed and the AC's cranking. So if you hear the background noise, it's real. If you hear a cricket or a bird, it's real. They've been compiling evidence. I think it was Colton was the last one mentioned in the opening audio piece. That's, of course, the Greg Kinnear movie. What was it called? Heaven is for Real. And I'm going to get into people that make money by selling those books and people that make money by being skeptics, because you've got to be able to counterbalance both. And you've got to be able to point the finger at, yeah, well, you know, Danyon Brinkley sold a whole bunch of books about his two NDEs. And, you know, who's to say he's not lying because he's making money? You can't argue that. You have to allow that. But also, you can also say to yourself, you know what? One of the most famous skeptics in the world runs a magazine called Skeptic Magazine. His name is Michael Shermer. So he's making money by saying it's not real. So on both sides of this argument, there is money being made. And you have to consider that. Unless someone just goes to an IANS conference, spends their 15 minutes on a microphone, never writes a book, never goes on a speaking tour, and all they wanted to do is share their stories. Well, guess what? Google IANS, IANDS, International Association for Near-Death Studies. And you'll see a room full of people all sitting there going, me too, me too. Holy crap, I'm not the only one. What's going on? I'm going to get to some audio here in a second. And I think I'm going to play this next piece. It's a little long, but I don't want to stop and start it because I think it flows really well. It is Dr. Jeffrey Long's mini doc where I think he interviews about a half a dozen people and they describe their experience. I don't think that anybody, just want to make sure, okay, yeah, I'm looking at my computer here, everything's good. We had some streaming issues last week. I don't think anybody should take any of this as pure science. Like, there's my fist, here's my hand, I can prove it's there. Well, guess what? At the quantum mechanic level, you're 99.99999% ether, space. You're just a bunch of atoms loosely connected. So everybody who thinks that this is a solid table, get an electron microscope and we'll prove you wrong. When it comes to the near-death experience, all I ask is that people keep an open mind. But I will tell you this before I play this piece. And you'll hear the concepts, and you hear the description of the light, the beings of light, the God force. All of that is individual specific to each person. I even posted this on my Facebook page, as I normally do when I do a show. And I had one person say I had an NDE, and then I had another person right below them say, no, my heart stopped. There's nothing after death. And then at least he had the balls to say, well, at least not for me. And that's how you have to approach this topic. But what if part of our evolution, part of our evolution of consciousness, part of what we think we are or know we are, as we grow, evolve, and change, could actually become real science? You know what Tesla said? He said the moment mankind starts to look into metaphysics and the science of spirituality, it will make more progress in a single year than it has made in 100. Maybe it's about freeing the mind. Maybe it's about realizing that maybe the body isn't exactly what you are. Niels Harrison, he's a he's not a neuroscientist. He's a, it slipped my mind, but he basically said looking for consciousness in the brain is like, again, I think I said this earlier, looking for consciousness in the brain is like looking inside a radio for the announcer. They can tell you where your eyes operate. They can tell you where your hearing works in your brain. They can tell you where your thought, consciousness works. They can tell you where your the feeling of touch and taste actually takes place in the brain. But where's the movie screen? Where do all five of those senses go gather and present itself as your experience? Where does that happen in the brain? They don't know. They don't know where consciousness takes place in the brain. They know that in the back of your brain and the way your eyes work and the rods and the cones and your vision comes in backwards, or I'm sorry, upside down, and then your brain reverses it so you see upright. They know that stuff. But if you were to say, where does my touch, taste, feeling, sense, where do those five senses all come together and party and give me my experience? They don't know. Mr. Spock would raise an eyebrow and he'd go, fascinating. I was more of a Sean Connery, but you know what I mean. So as we go through the show tonight, and when you hear from Eben Alexander, this guy, Eben Alexander is a neurosurgeon. He had meningitis, and I'm not going to tell the whole story because he does it well. I think he was raised Christian. I think he became agnostic or an atheist. Well, not so much anymore. And he'll explain, because he knew his brain had been damaged beyond repair by the meningitis, that his consciousness was not supposed to be operating at all. Basically a diseased brain. Yet he had a vivid near-death experience. I already mentioned Pam Reynolds. There's a Vicky, blind since death. Jessica, talking about the thing that fascinates me the most about the NDE is called the life review. And Dr. Kenneth Ring, you'll hear a little bit from. He'll also mention that tonight. Got a lot of audio to get to. And I don't want to. And also, Dr. Lloyd Rudy, he's a heart surgeon. And he'll just describe one patient and how this guy completely locked up and was considered dead. And they were going to call the coroner in and they had to do an autopsy. And lo and behold, 45 minutes later, boop, boop. Boop, boop. a small heartbeat begins. So this piece of audio is going to run, let me see here, we're looking at, it's a little over 10 minutes. But you'll hear from six different people. You'll also hear Jeffrey Long in there. And then you'll hear them describe a little bit of their experience. And even more importantly, at the end, how they felt about it. I'm going to say that I'm probably going to say this a dozen times tonight. This does not prove, without a shadow of a doubt, that there is life after death, that your consciousness, you know, can transcend the physical realm. But it sure makes you damn curious. And if you're willing to keep an open mind, I think you're going to have a good time tonight. I think you're going to enjoy the stories. Now, if you're an atheist, most of the time I hear someone who's an atheist, I go, let me guess. You're an atheist because you reject the dogmas, the fables, and the stories of organized religion. They go, of course. I go, okay. That's like shooting fish in a barrel. Living in the belly of a whale, creating an ark and making sure the mosquitoes get on it. These are stories with morals attached. It doesn't mean they actually happened. So what the atheist will do is go after that organized religion because it is so easy to call out. And I don't have any qualms with that. I go, guess what? If something's bullshit, call it out. And don't be afraid to. But don't become what you detest. The angry atheist is the other side of the coin of the hardcore religious person who's absolutely sure there's a God, and the atheist is absolutely sure there isn't one. They're basically two sides of the same coin, though neither can absolutely prove they're correct. Rather than go into a conversation and say, hey, guess what? That's really a bullshit story. It really rained fire in Sodom and Gomorrah and people turned to salt? Okay, maybe not. But does that rule out all the possibilities? So I have an open mind. I have atheist friends. I have agnostic friends. I have Catholic friends. Of course, I grew up Catholic, so I still have friends that are, you know, stand by their religious beliefs. My sister is a Catholic nun. And we've had beautiful conversations about spirituality where she goes, you know, Scott, there are many, many mysteries, but I believe in Jesus and I believe this. And I'm like, that's okay, sis. You're a good person. You're moralistic. And I don't mean in some kind of judgmental way. You're trying to be love rather than fear. And I think it's beautiful. And I always pat her on the back and say, I'm proud of you. But she knows I don't necessarily believe in those stories. But I don't shut the door and slam it in her face, going, you're full of shit. Do your best anytime you look into something to keep an open mind. So check this out. I'm going to let this run a while. This is I've whittled it down to about 10 minutes. It's really about a 17-minute documentary. I had to whittle it down a little bit. I'm just going to roll with it. In lieu of playing music tonight, in lieu of a Carlin's Corner, I want you to hear these stories. Don't formulate an opinion, but at least keep an open mind. Okay? Deal? Good. Now, there's one thing we will be doing tonight. And tonight's toast is to the open-minded critical thinker, a person that's not afraid to stand up for what they believe, but a person who's also willing to say, you know what? I don't know. Because the ego doesn't like you to say that. The ego is like, I'm not going to say I don't know. Guess what? You should. There's nothing wrong with that. Or say, I'm undecided. Or I'm unsure. Phrase it any way you want, but keep an open mind. All right, I'll be back in a few. We're going to let this, hang on. We're going to let this roll tonight. This is Dr. Jeffrey Long and about five or six different near-death experiencers. And when we come back, I won't stop and start this one, but I will on a couple of the audio pieces I have tonight. It's a dangerous conversation. I'm Ledge, and we'll talk to you in a few.
Near-death experience may be defined as a lucid experience that occurs at a time of an imminent life-threatening event. And yet, at a time of unconsciousness, people are having these vivid, lucid experiences.
In a moment, I was just somewhere else.
All of a sudden, I heard a voice.
I did not want to believe this.
I live my life through that experience.
There's millions of Americans that have had a near-death experience. They're not rare. When I first heard about near-death experiences, I thought they were so fantastic that I wanted to believe this, but an extraordinary claim like that requires extraordinary evidence.
I certainly understand people's skepticism about this. If it hadn't happened to me, I'd be skeptical about it too. Was I just suffering from hypoxia, which is just oxygen starvation of the brain? Was this something that could have brought about this hallucination?
I sat there and thought to myself, this story just sounds crazy. Nobody's going to believe this. I mean, I was a pretty big spiritual skeptic, and to say those things or to even think about that experience was just, it was a lot for me to take in.
I did not want to believe this, but I've been in the presence of dying people more than any skeptic I've ever met, and I have argued with the best of them.
It's a global type of experience, and we have tons of people from all over the world who have submitted their near-death experience.
I think what drives my belief was the overwhelming consistency of the NDE elements and of what NDEers are telling us. Very commonly, the first event in an NDE is a separation of consciousness, that being their point of vision and what they can hear actually separates from the body.
Boom, I was back up sitting in the corner of this room, looking at my body, which is still laying there on this table.
You're not really floating. It's not like floating. You're actually standing, and then you're up. And you could look around and see things that are happening.
First, I heard a woman's voice saying, "I'm not getting a pulse. I'm not getting a pulse." And I turned to her, and with the same sense of reality with which I am now speaking, I said, "Of course you're getting a pulse. Otherwise, I wouldn't be talking." I had no sense of being in physical danger at all.
Following that, commonly in near-death experiences, they'll go through a tunnel. And as they go to the end of that tunnel, they may encounter a light, they may encounter a being. And following that, they can often be in some unearthly, or if you will, heavenly realm.
I was whirling through this tunnel, and there were these light streaks that I was kind of going by. And I was coming out into this big, sort of luminous gray-white cloud.
This is the point of the experience when it's really difficult to really articulate the events that happened, because any terms I use are not going to be all that accurate.
And then there was a light that came that blew away all the gray foggy material, and talk about no words. It was so bright. I could see. It was so bright. It was brighter than our sun, but no squinting. It was all love. It sounds so, I don't know. I have never found a way to talk about this light.
It just took my breath away. I just had to sit there for a moment and think about how beautiful this place was.
That was the real world there. You know, that was really home.
Following that, there's often a life review. Life reviews occur in about a fourth of near-death experiences.
The review was everything that ever happened to me. And yet it seemed to happen in just a matter of moments, and I saw it from three perspectives simultaneously. It was as though I was looking through my own eyes, experiencing it again as I first had, and then I was experiencing it through the eyes of everyone with whom I'd ever interacted, and then it was sort of this sort of omniscient viewpoint where I could see everything. I got absolutely no judgment whatsoever. What I got was this tidal wave that hit me of this feeling of unconditional love and acceptance.
I began to notice that there was someone in front of me. This person had been with me through every decision that I had made, and it was the most natural conversation when we began to speak. It was the most natural thing in the world to me.
We started talking about my life up to that point, but there wasn't any blame attached to it. It was almost more a matter of, well, I've done these things, but there's things I haven't done. Now, at the same time this is all happening, I am moving around a series of, like, light bins, would be the best way to put it. And I know that if I go far enough around the light bins, I won't be coming back this way.
Very often, near-death experiencers will then be involved in a choice as to whether to leave this heavenly, joyous realm that they're in and return to Earth.
Someone definitely from outside of me put a question to me that commanded an answer. And the question was, Libby, are you ready?
The feeling that I was getting was that it was okay, either way. I could die or I could live, and everything's going to be just fine.
I was being told that if I went through that window, I would not go back. I was having a great time. I was in heaven.
I started to say yes, and then unbeknownst and unexpectedly to myself, out came the answer, no, I can't go, I haven't finished yet.
And it's very, very difficult for near-death experiencers to come to the decision that they're going to return to Earth, often to a world of hurt and pain, recovering from their life-threatening event. And yet, obviously, these near-death experiencers ultimately do decide to return. They want to come back because of some types of lessons that they need to learn, and it's important for them to come back to complete learning those lessons. Can you put yourself in the shoes of someone who's had a near-death experience? As soon as they start to recover and get over this incredible traumatic event, there's a lot going on in their mind. They may not even know for sure that they're going to survive and go on living.
I was sort of overloaded with what had just happened with me. It was though I was an appliance built for 110 volts plugged into 220.
I went through a long period of not wanting to tell hardly anybody about it.
And I decided then to just not say anything about it, because it just sounded too crazy to me.
I had to settle for myself whether or not I had had a psychotic episode.
The near-death experience is so profoundly different from anything that they ever experienced in their life. Very, very difficult for these near-death experiencers to slowly start to have the courage to share this with other people.
And what I think is more interesting in my life is what happened after the light. I changed. I wound up in graduate school of social work, going into the field of death and dying. A good fit. I wasn't afraid of death. Wonder why.
The number one thing is that they come back and they do not have a fear of death.
The fear of death is certainly gone, and when it comes my time to go, I'm ready.
Some people do come back endowed by special gifts. Very often these gifts are described as being of increasing sensitivity to other people, sort of an intuitiveness that operates at a very high level. They can be very intuitive, very empathic with regard to other people, especially their emotions.
After my near-death experience, I came back with a real heightened sense of intuition.
We just look at life a little different. I want to still work. I want to play music as much as I can. And I want to help other people because I'm so fortunate.
It's like I'm back to have really outrageous experiences and then turn them into a way to help other people. And thus started the whole idea of having support groups. And now they exist around the world through this organization, the International Association for Near-Death Studies.
I had no idea that there were actually groups of people that got together and shared these experiences.
And as I sat there and listen to some of these people, I'm going, uh-oh. There's other people that get this too.
And it was absolutely wonderful to find this group. And then, of course, the icing on the cake was my meeting Paul when I did.
It has changed my entire life. It changed the way I felt about how I wanted to live my life, how I wanted to fit in.
Kenneth Ring, PhD, had come to town from the International Association for Near-Death Studies to meet near-death experiencers with research potential.
I have had a long time to wonder, what does this all mean?
We're all connected on some level.
I could see how my life was affecting the world.
The point of being here is to love and to grow. And this is school. And there are lessons that we're all supposed to understand.
Well, I think in the overall, for us here, this is just a learning thing. This is just a very small stop on a bigger picture.
As an expert, the most professional expert thing I can tell you about what it all means and what is the meaning of life is, I don't know.
Everybody is going to experience what I experienced at some point. Most of the time, people don't come back from it. It's called dying.
The near-death experience for the entire world, for each and every one of us, is a profound message of hope. That message of hope is we don't really die, that we're going to continue to have a life after we die, and that it's wonderful.
I want to make sure that when my friends go by my casket at the end, I don't want them to say, gee, it looks pretty good. I want them to say, he couldn't have lived another day.
That is a compilation done by a mini doc by one of the many researchers in the near-death experience phenomena, Dr. Jeffrey Long. Just Google him. You're going to hear a lot of names tonight. If you download the show, take your time, write the names down, and look into it yourself. Come to your own conclusions. And like I said, you honestly, if you're going to be honest, you can't say this is absolute proof that there's life after death. You can't do that. Now, I want to get into the idea that people make money doing this. Danyon Brinkley, Betty Eady, I'm trying to think of the names off the top of my head. Colton, the movie that was done with Greg Kinnear. Anytime someone writes a book and makes money, the skeptic is going to go, oh, sure. You make up some fine story about angels and meeting your long-lost relatives. Meanwhile, you just made $1.2 million selling a book to a bunch of suckers who are afraid to die. How is that any different than the Bible or the Quran or anything? You know what? It's a good, valid point. You have to be honest about it. But who am I to tell you that you can't make a buck telling your story? It would be great if a whole bunch of near-death experiencers didn't want to speak in public. I said this earlier. Didn't want to pen a book. They simply wanted to share the story, and that's what IONS is. And I think there's one other, I can't remember the acronym, but there's another group out there. And they're doing that kind of research, too. So as you can hear the people, some of them absolutely do a great job of going, I was here, this is what I felt. And other, did you notice that a lot of people say, I can't find the words? Now, when you get into people like Michael Shermer, or if you get into Susan Blackmore, she's a psychologist, they say it's just a dying brain, it's serotonin, or it's DMT, or it's something released in the brain to ease you into death. And that none of these things, many people think it's like ayahuasca, like a trippy event, like a mushroom or LSD experience. But there's too much structure to the NDE. If it was just like, oh, I saw triangles and geometric shapes, and then I would say that's probably a little bit more of what you hear about in an LSD trip or a psilocybin trip. These people are talking about the OBE, out-of-body experience. 37% of those people that have ever felt like they had a near-death experience, that's almost 40% said they left their body, looked back on their body, looked down. I remember reading some of Kenneth Ring's books, and the people that were, and this is ironic, because you don't see your face in three dimensions. It's impossible. You can see your hand in three dimensions. You can see your foot in three dimensions. But you cannot see your own face. Every time you see your face, when you look in a mirror, it's two-dimensional. Unless someone actually makes a three-dimensional sculpture of your head, you don't know what your face looks like three-dimensionally. It's impossible. And a lot of these people would look back on their own body on a slab or in the road or in an ambulance, and they didn't recognize themselves for a couple seconds. Can you imagine that? I realized, oh my God, that's me. For the first time ever, you've seen your own face three-dimensionally. Like, you would look at me and see my face three-dimensionally, my big old nose, I would look the same thing at you. But I can't see my own face three-dimensionally. It's impossible. That's just one of the things in Lessons from the Light by Kenneth Ring that I said, you know what? Imagine that. Imagine you're looking back on your own body and it takes you a few seconds to recognize that it's you. That's pretty fascinating. Do some more audio here in a second. We're going to hear from Pam Reynolds, and she'll tell her own story. And I believe the Pam Reynolds story either has Susan Blackmore. I wanted to make sure we got some skeptics in there, too. So what I had to do is kind of take the skeptic and splice it in, going back and forth, so you would get an explanation from a Michael Shermer from Skeptic Magazine or someone else that is discounting what someone else is saying. Because I think it's important to be skeptical about this. Like I said, you're going to hear me say at least a dozen times tonight, this is not a definitive proof. But the stories are fascinating. Now, Pam Reynolds, like I said, she's passed away. She's gone. She actually had, I believe, two NDEs. And then she died of heart failure a while ago. But basically, she had an aneurysm inside her brain. That's a long piece of audio, too. But I think we'll do some stop and starts on this one. I have so much audio to get to tonight, so just be patient with me and realize I've got to squeeze all of this into 3 hours. I'm already done with hour number one here. That I want to get you as much information, and I guess you could say testimony, though that's kind of a religious term, about this experience and how it affected people and their own personal experience. Now, I've had people since when I was doing Radio IO 2-3 years ago, some of the first shows I did, one of them was about an NDE, about the NDE, but I didn't come in with as much audio, but I do remember hearing from people, and believe it or not, I actually heard from 2 or 3 people via email that said, I had a similar experience. I tried to tell my religious parents about it, and they said, did you see Jesus? It was like the first question out of their mind, out of their mouth. Did you see Jesus? No. Well, then it couldn't have been real. You know, in other words, everyone's got their construct, and if you've got to stick to your construct to feel safe, you know what? It's your journey. Go for it. I'm not going to sit there and tell you that guy didn't see Jesus, or this person didn't see Krishna, or this person didn't see a magical wizard in a candy castle. But what I can say is, excuse me, some of the research about NDEs, by the way, when Moody penned his book, he said about 8 million people, 600 people a day now are having near-death experiences and reporting them. That's in our country. That's 600 a day. Some of the stats, 37% say they have an OBE. 62%, that's almost two-thirds, say they see a light or were in a light. And the light wasn't just like a bright light. It was a being. It had communication. And by the way, most people talk about telekinesis here. They don't talk about moving their actual mouth, those words vibrating air molecules. Those air molecules travel to someone's ear and someone hears it. This is communication of pure thought, back and forth, simultaneously. Actually carrying on more than one conversation at the same time. And speaking of time, this phenomena, for most of these people, transcends the concept of time. Remember, time's a construct. It's a measure of movement and space between two points. Einstein proved that well. And that's been proven in quantum mechanics, that time is a construct. So what if you're in a realm where there is no physicality? There's no you, point A, point B, and the point in between, and the space in between. There's just your consciousness and another consciousness. You could, in 1 second, have a, let's use the word hour conversation, because there is no time. I know it's a little hard to wrap your brain around, but realize that if you are a permanent piece of consciousness, and you are in a realm where there is no space, objects, no body, no hands, no eyes, no ears, but you still exist somehow, then there is no time. 62% say they were in a light, saw light, communicated with a light. The life review we're going to get to a little bit later, but I will let you know, you heard it earlier, about one in every four NDE people have a look back at their life in three dimensions, in a panoramic view, simultaneously. Picture it this way. You're in an IMAX theater. Over to your far left is your birth. Over to your far right is where you drowned and had your NDE. Everything in between is your life. Every freaking second of that is all taking place at the same time, and you can comprehend it all. That just blows my mind. 52% said they either ran into a loved one, dead relative, or another being. 91%, and you heard some of the people in that last piece of audio, said they came back changed. How is this phenomenon being ignored? Why? What does this do to organized religion? What does this do to some book that tells you you have to be this, you have to believe this, and you can't deny this, or this will happen, and this will... This severely challenges most organized dogmas. That's why they try to co-opt it and bend it into their belief system, because the phenomenon isn't just growing. It's not growing. The reports and documentation are growing. The scientific studies are growing. You'll hear about someone who actually put a picture. I'll stop and start when I get to that audio. Man, I got so much to get to tonight. And 54%, you heard this in the last piece of audio I played, come back with some type of, quote, paranormal sensitivity, unquote. Some people have reported, I just mentioned time, some people that have had an NDE reported that when they put a watch on their wrist, it stops working. When they take it off, it works. Now, I can't verify this, but think about the concept of time. If time doesn't exist, and you put it on your wrist, and you've gone to this place where time does not exist, where 1 second is a bazillion years, and a bazillion years equals 1 second, then a watch is pretty much useless. Many people become clairvoyant. Many people can predict. Many people report they can predict things in the future. How is this phenomenon not on the news like once a week? Because it challenges so much status quo. And even more importantly, if you look at governments, if you look at religions, if you look at all the things that control what you think and feel the world is and you are and your place and what the earth is and what the universe is, this challenges all of it. They're afraid of this. And when I started reading about these books, none of these videos were available. This was 98, 99. I literally would go to, you know, Barnes & Noble, every bookstore. I would go to, and it's kind of funny, the New Age section used to be called occult. It literally used to be called the occult. Because on one side of the bookshelf was all this, and on the other side was the Bible and the standardized story of what you are. What you've been told during your baptism. If you deny Jesus, this, that, and this will happen. If you deny Krishna, if you deny Buddha, blah, 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 right on down the line. And that's dangerous. Where's that word? There it is right behind me in a poster. I got so much audio, I got to get going on this. All right, let's start with this. Oh, by the way, told you my windows are open. That's not for me, I hope. All right, this is Pam Reynolds. We'll get to some of her story. I'm not sure if it's Susan Blackmore or Michael Shermer who's in on this. And I will stop and start this a little bit and comment on the way.
Here we go with this story. You guys ready? Here we go.
In Atlanta, Georgia, one particular case was about to astonish experts and doctors. Dr. Michael Sabon, a cardiologist, was also studying near-death experiences when he came across one extraordinary account.
Pam's case is unique in the fact that she had her near-death experience at a time that she was fully instrumented and under medical observation. And I think if you wanted to construct a laboratory experiment where you had someone and took them as close to death or perhaps even into death as possible, and then bring them back and ask them what they could recall, Pam's case probably comes closest to that than any other so far that we know of.
Pam Reynolds was an established songwriter, singer, and a busy working mother. In 1991, she became seriously ill.
I began to experience extreme dizziness, loss of speech, some difficulty in moving the body. And it was at that point that my physician recommended that I have a CAT scan. And the CAT scan, of course, showed the aneurysm. And it was a big one. It was a giant aneurysm. I was referred to a neurologist, and the neurologist gave me little or no chance of survival at all.
But for Pam, there was one last hope. She made what she assumed would be her last journey, 2,000 miles to the Barrow Neurological Institute in Phoenix, Arizona.
I remember the bright sunshine. The light in Phoenix, Arizona is piercing from sunup on. And I remember getting into the shower. I had been given a scrub kit with a hard bristle brush and an antibacterial solution to reduce the chances of infection, I'm sure. To this day, I can remember the stinging of that brush and that solution on my skin. I can remember being placed on a gurney. I remember the squeaking of the wheels.
Neurosurgeon Dr. Robert Spetzler decided to take on Pam's case against all odds.
What we're looking at is the aneurysm that she had, which is at the very base of the brain. This is the balloon that can burst and cause this incredible catastrophe in the patient's brain. Why is this so difficult in this particular case? I think probably easiest to see here by when you look at this plastic model.
Right now he's opening up that plastic model and he's showing you if you move from the top of the brain down, this aneurysm is in the middle of her brain at the bottom. Inaccessible unless you literally cut her brain open.
Of the head. And we turn it around and we take out the top of the brain. What we're really talking about is that aneurysm is all the way at the very base of the brain. And that is why it's so incredibly difficult to get there.
Pam's body temperature would be lowered to between 10 and 15 degrees centigrade. Her heart and breathing stopped, her brain waves flattened, and the blood drained from her head. She would be clinically dead for a whole hour of the operation.
Okay, I think this is important because a lot of people say this is nothing but brain, you know, drugs released by the brain. In other words, serotonin and all these things, because you're in a stressful moment. You know, oh, you're not really dead. You still have oxygen circulating through your brain. You still have blood. No. None of that was happening in this woman's case.
What we want to do is we want to bring that brain to a halt. We don't just want the brain to be asleep. We want the metabolic activity of the brain to stop. Every measurable output that the body puts out really disappears completely, so that you have no measurable neuronal activity whatsoever. Prior to the operation starting, a lot of activity goes on. The patient is put to sleep. The eyes are taped shut. There are little clicking devices put in each ear in order to monitor the brain. The patient is then completely covered. The only thing that's really exposed is the area of the head where we work.
I don't remember an operating room. I don't remember seeing Dr. Spetzler at all. I was with a fellow. One of his fellows was with me at that time. After that, nothing. Absolutely nothing. Until the sound.
I know, it's freaking me out too. It's a bone saw. They had to cut through her skull.
And the sound was unpleasant. It was guttural. It was reminiscent of being in a dentist office. And I remember the top of my head tingling. And I just sort of popped out of the top of my head. And I was then looking.
A lot of people report that, by the way, people that have near-death experiences, when they say they leave their body, a lot of them feel like rubber bands snapping, and a lot of them say that they left their body through the top of their head. In other words, they didn't leave through their wrist. For some reason, they exited their body through the top of their head.
Came down at the body. I knew it was my body, but I didn't care. My vantage point was sort of sitting on the doctor's shoulder. I remember the instrument in his hand. It looked like the handle to my electric toothbrush. I had assumed that they were going to open the skull with a saw. I had heard the term saw, but what I saw looked a lot more like a drill than a saw. It even had little bits that were kept in this case that looked like the case that my father stored his socket wrenches in when I was a child. And I remember distinctly hearing a female voice saying,
"We have a problem. Your arteries are too small.
Try the other side."
It seemed to come from further down on the table. I do remember wondering, what are they doing? Because this is brain surgery. And what had happened was they accessed the femoral arteries in order to drain the blood. And I did not understand that.
At that stage in the operation, nobody can observe, hear in that state. And I find it inconceivable that your normal senses, such as hearing, let alone the fact that she had clicking modules in each ear, that there was any way for her to hear those through normal auditory pathways.
So remember now, this woman had her blood drained from her brain. But somehow she's observing the entire operation. This is the science part of this phenomenon, where you start to say, well, wait a minute. If the brain is how we perceive life, if it is the culmination of our five senses, but the brain's shut off, no blood, no oxygen, how is this woman perceiving this? How is this woman watching this? This is where the spirituality or the consciousness soul is meeting the scientific knowledge, or what we think, at least at this point, we absolutely know about how the brain works.
I felt a presence. I sort of turned around to look at it, and that's when I saw the very tiny pinpoint of light. And the light started to pull me. There's a physical sensation to the pulling, and I know how that must sound. Nonetheless, it's true. There was a physical sensation, rather like going over a hill real fast.
That's important. Remember now, she's out of her body. Now, if I'm out of my body, How can I feel gravity? How can I feel being pulled or pushed or prodded? So there is the sensation, as she's describing, even though she's not in her body, at least as she's describing this, that she's still feeling a pulling effect. In other words, I'm here, this light is there, and that light is pulling me from point A to point B. Now, remember, no physical body, but she's still feeling the effect. She even said it's like driving over a hill like a roller coaster, that kind of stuff.
Tell me. And I went toward the light. The closer I got to the light, I began to discern different figures, different people, and I distinctly heard my grandmother call me. She has a very distinct voice. And I immediately went to her. And it felt great. And I saw an uncle who passed away when he was only 39 years old. He taught me a lot. He taught me to play my first guitar. And I saw many, many people I knew and many, many I didn't know. But I knew that I was somehow in some way connected to them. I asked if God was the light. And the answer was no, God is not the light. The light is what happens when God breathes.
It's kind of heavy. First time I heard that, I was like, whoa. God is not that light that they describe. That light is the breath of God. That's pretty heavy. That's pretty heavy.
And I distinctly remember thinking, I'm standing in the breath of God. At some point in time, I was reminded that it was time to go back. Of course, I had made my decision to go back before I ever laid down on that table. But, you know, the more I was there, the better I liked it. And my uncle was the one who brought me back down to the body.
By the way, many people that have had NDEs describe not wanting to come back. Now, think about that for a second. If you think you are your body, and the only way you are in existence is you need to be in your body and your brain. Yet during this experience, you don't want to go back to whatever that feeling is. Can you imagine what the feeling is in the light, grandma, grandpa? In other words, that feels like home. Your body feels like temporary. Many people have described this feeling.
But then I got to where the body was, and I looked at the thing, and I for sure did not want to get in it, because it looked pretty much like what it was, as in void of life. And I knew it would hurt, so I didn't want to get in. And he kept reasoning with me. He says, it's like diving into a swimming pool, just jump in. No. What about the children? You know what? I think the children will be fine. Honey, you've got to go. No. He pushed me. He gave me a little help there. It's taken a long time, but I think I'm ready to forgive him for that. But I landed. I saw the body jump. I saw it do this number. And then he pushed me, and I felt it do this number.
This is a classic near-death experience occurring under extremely monitored medical conditions, where every known vital sign and basically every clinical sign of life and death was being monitored at the time. And that's what makes her case so remarkable and so valuable to us.
I don't have an explanation for it. I don't know how it's possible for it to happen, considering the physiological state she's in.
Now think about that for a second. These are doctors. They have their opinion on who you are, what you are, how your brain works. Again, the five senses, they culminate. They create your experience inside your brain. Again, we don't know where that experience coagulates. We don't know where that movie screen is, where your life is playing out, because they can't find it in the brain. Maybe it's not there. Maybe your brain is simply the processor of the soul. I don't like using religious terms, but maybe the brain is simply the processor of the experience. For instance, I'm looking at a computer screen right now, right? I'm looking at an experience, but guess what? There's a processor bringing that experience to me. I also want to say something right now. People that want to reject this automatically, they're going to reject it for one or two reasons. Mostly the same reason. They've been raised in a religion and they're not going to budge and they need to do what they, you know, so be it. But a lot of people seem to think that when you start dropping the G word on people, that, oh, geez, you know, you're going to tell me there's a God and you're going to tell me because maybe you're thinking about your life. Maybe you think you're going to get judged. Have you heard anyone so far say that that light, that being, that essence, that place was judgmental or damning? Many people are kind of like when they think about an afterlife, what's the first thing you think about? Your life and punishment and damnation and paying your dues and all that shit. Maybe that's not going to happen. God, I have to use so many words tonight, like maybe this and what if, because it's pretty cool. Let's get to Dr. Jeffrey Long here in a second. I'm sorry, Dr. Evan Alexander. Again, by the way, to be into total disclosure, Dr. Evan Alexander, and you'll hear some of the story, wrote a book. He's a neurosurgeon. Now, I don't know. I'm not a doctor. I don't know how meningitis works, but I do know that it's essentially a disease slime that coats your brain and kills it, rots it. And it can do it in a matter of hours or days. And sometimes you don't even know it's there, and suddenly you're in a coma. And he'll describe his experience here. And I think this is where we'll hear both either Susan Blackmore, psychologist, skeptic, and or Michael Shermer, skeptic. People say, oh, you know, because I had when I did the Radio Io show, I had a neuroscientist on. Her name is Cara Santa Maria. When we talked to her, she was dating Bill Maher. She's an atheist, raised very religious. I'll say it again. Many atheists I know are atheists because they reject that strict religious upbringing. This is this. That's not that. This is God. That's bullshit. And they reject it. And I don't blame them. But they go from all the way in one side of the pendulum to all the way on the other side. Instead of thinking, geez, I've been fed a line of man-made religion and book and doctrines and just look into how the Bible was built and during the Roman times and how they took the Celtic religions and mixed it in and how you had two different faiths going on in Rome and the politics involved and the Council of Nicaea and how Constantine got all these bishops together and they decided what went in the Bible, what didn't go in the Bible. They actually voted like a Congress would vote on whether Jesus was divine or not, or the story of Jesus. Just like you and I would vote, that was the same way the Bible was built. So when people learn this stuff, and reject, what they do is they reject all of it, instead of keeping at least a sliver of open-mindedness to going, what if? I don't want to be a preacher here tonight. But I do want to say, what if? I think it's vital. I think it's the most important discovery mankind will ever make. If we do, we don't, I don't know. But I do know that more and more people are coming forward with their stories. More and more of the institutes are doing their studies. And little by little, as the evidence compiles, or at least the stories compile, remember, these are stories. You know, it's not like you can say, oh, here's my pen. It's right here in front of me. I can see it. Therefore, it exists. But I can't tell you my story exists because it happened to me in my brain or in my consciousness or in my soul. I can't stand there in front of you and show it to you. Therefore, I can't prove it to you. Because we are physical beings in a three-dimensional universe, matrix, and everything, you know, when I pinch my skin, it hurts. It's reality. At least what I've been told is. Evan Alexander, I think, is one of the more fascinating stories because this man is a neurosurgeon. This isn't some guy. And by the way, we'll get to Vicky Norotic, who was Norotic, I think is the way we say her name, born blind at birth. We'll get to her story next. But I think Evan Alexander's story, I think, might contain Michael Schumer. I'm pretty sure that's the one. And we'll do some stop and starts here. Like I said, I have a ton of audio tonight, and I don't really want to keep reiterating my same thoughts, but I do want to make sure that as we go through this process tonight, that we aren't afraid to go on both sides of this. And I do remember Michael Schumer making some statements, and I'm pretty sure this is it. Now, Evan Alexander had meningitis. You know, let's let them tell a story. Here we go.
You know, before this, I'd spent 20 years in academic neurosurgery. I thought I had a pretty good idea how the brain works and how it generates consciousness. I'd heard occasional near-death experience stories, and I was certain that there would be some brain explanation.
Evan Alexander is a Harvard-trained neurosurgeon. He put his faith in logic, in rational thought. Then in 2008, he spent 7 days in a coma. Now, he's a believer.
As a neurosurgeon, has this experience changed your thinking about life?
It has totally changed everything about my thinking.
Most people have some idea of what happens when we die. If you do indeed believe in heaven, it usually involves white clouds, bright lights, mountain tops. Well, Dr. Alexander is a man of science and of medicine. Well, he says he's been to the other side, and now he's back to tell us what it was really like.
What you saw or what you felt is God. Is that your definition?
Yes.
Were you a man of faith before this?
Before my coma, I had no belief whatsoever in a personal loving God.
Adopted as a baby, Eben grew up in a conventionally Christian family.
If you had asked me before my coma, how much would a patient who was extremely sick and should have died from a severe case of bacterial meningitis, how much would they remember? I would have said nothing. They would not remember a single thing.
That all changed when this life-saving surgeon suddenly found himself facing his own mortality.
November 10, 2008. It didn't really start off as being very good, did it?
No, it was basically like being struck by a freight train. Woke up at 4:30 in the morning, had severe back pain like nothing I'd ever felt before. It was a very severe meningitis, and the CT scans showed that it coated my entire brain. There wasn't any part of my neocortex that was left unscathed.
For 7 days, Dr. Alexander was in a coma. He was all but lifeless, completely unconscious. Yet he experienced a consciousness that defied all his years of medical training.
Here was this beautiful melody and this light spinning closer and closer. It opened up as a portal into this gorgeous realm that was verdant, waterfalls, colors indescribable, and millions of butterflies flying through, a very ultra-real scene. And then there was a warm breeze blowing through that was like the breath of divine.
In the hospital, his doctors were losing hope.
My physicians were telling my wife that basically she'd be raising our sons alone. My 10-year-old son, Bond, had heard that, realized it was very bad news, came running into my room, pried my eyes open, "Daddy, you're going to be okay. Daddy, you're going to be okay. Daddy, you're going to be okay." As if he said it enough, it would make it true.
So your son was calling you back.
I had to come back. I had to claw my way up out of that very deep hole and somehow do whatever was necessary. He was pleading with me.
On the seventh day, against all odds, Dr. Alexander awoke. By medical standards, he made a miraculously quick recovery. But nagging the doctor was how to explain what he'd felt and seen.
This infinite blackness that was filled with love and yet also filled with this light from this brilliant orb that was with me and the divine, loving, infinitely powerful consciousness of the deity that created it all.
I mean, you realize how this sounds, though. It can come across as a bit crazy.
It does. Of course it does. When I was, you know, I had first gotten home from the hospital, I'd mentioned some of this to my doctors. They would go, "Oh, yes, you are very sick."
Many scientists say such an experience can't be real. Michael Shermer was once a born-again Christian. Today, he's America's most famous skeptic. So what do you think really happened? What's the scientific explanation behind his experience?
The scientific explanation behind Alexander's experience is nothing more than a near-death experience, an out-of-body experience, an altered state triggered by a stressful event.
Was it just a fantasy before death? Was it your brain basically telling you you're about to die, and it's a nice way of shutting down all the systems and making it a pleasant way to exit?
Well, it's very important to remember that I had a severe bacterial meningitis that had greatly damaged and destroyed my neocortex, the part of our brain that makes us human, the part that allows for any kind of conscious experience. So that with that amount of destruction, there was no way to have a dream, a hallucination, a fantasy, a confabulation. Those things could not occur because that part of my brain was gone.
Now think about that for a second. Many people, including Shermer, say this is simply the brain. Cara Santa Maria, who I had on my IO show a while ago, said this is simply the brain's dying last moments. And it's way of ushering you back to nothingness. Will you die? Nothing after the fact. Essentially, it's a soft way to end it. Well, if the brain is rotting and the brain can't give you the normal experience, how is this taking place? And this is why Eben Alexander's his own story is so fascinating.
It doesn't matter how rare the meningitis, none of that matters, because these things can be triggered by any number of conditions. We know, for example, that in a study of pilots accelerated in a centrifuge as part of their training, thousands of near-death and out-of-body experiences in pilots as they were passing out, as they're passing through that fuzzy borderlands between being consciously awake and being completely unconscious, they report as they are going under, passing through a tunnel, floating out of their body, the white light at the end of the tunnel. So there's certain common themes to these experiences that everybody has because our brains are all wired up through the same neurochemistry.
Okay, now, The follow-up question to Shermer should have been, yeah, but that's a functioning brain in a body that's heart is still beating. Maybe it's losing a little blood, but this isn't a rotting, dying brain in a person who's been in a hospital bed for 7 days. And that's what I would have said to Shermer. I would have said, listen, I get it. I've heard the same stories, you know, again, the centrifuge is how they test you, your G-forces and how much you can receive and what happens with pilots the way the body is wired, the blood drains out of the brain, the oxygen leaves the brain, and you can have an OBE. These are proven. So I have to agree with Shermer on the idea that, yes, these constructs have happened, but he's trying to say that a healthy pilot brain and a beating heart inside a centrifuge is the same thing as a man with meningitis. And I get it. And by the way, I'll say this again. I said this earlier. This man makes a very healthy living with Skeptic Magazine. And remember I talked about the pendulum going from one extreme to the other? Wasn't he raised as a born-again Christian? And now he's all the way on the other side. And he's making a healthy living doing it, too, by the way.
My rational, scientific brain says it's all crazy. And then the other part of me says, look, I know it happened.
Eben Alexander's story is a familiar one for Carmel Bell. In 2009, while at home in Melbourne, she went into cardiac arrest.
The next thing I consciously know is that I looked down and saw me lying in bed on my back. And I went, oh, that's me. I must be dead. I found myself in classically, I guess, what is known as heaven. There were stars, just the sky was full of stars. There were two other beings waiting to speak to me. One of these beings was 7 or 8 feet tall with these amazing eyes.
Wait a minute now. Why are all the beings always bigger than we are? What's wrong with a ghostly midget, a little person? Why are heavenly beings always huge and we're always tiny? I'm just, curious.
That actually turned out to be the Archangel Metatron.
Metatron. By the way, if you've ever seen the movie Dogma, Alanis Morissette plays God. I can't remember the actor who plays Metatron. But that's a reference to this guy.
And with him was a slightly smaller man who said that he was Jesus.
Who is Metatron?
He's meant to be the voice of God.
Well, even his name, Metatron, it sounds like something out of Transformer.
I know.
Megatron.
That's exactly what I think.
How did you know you'd met Jesus and this archangel? Did they say their names? Or
yes, they did. They introduced themselves.
Okay, I've still got no pulse, mate.
Hi there. Some people call me Jesus. Other people call me Jesus. The important thing to remember here is remember the religious upbringing. If people are raised Christian and they have this phenomenon take place in their mind or their body or their experience, they are probably, most likely, the way the research shows, going to reference a being by the name, like I said, the 3-year-old in the candy castle. This is what I liked about Melvin Moore's research, was he wanted to interview children who hadn't been indoctrinated into a religious system, dogma, and rules yet. This woman had.
Firemen and paramedics worked desperately to save Carmel. After 47 minutes, they were about to give up.
And all of a sudden, Scotty was doing a compression and the chest dropped on its own. And then the pigmentation of her skin changed. And we all looked at each other and go, wow, we've got a result.
Carmel came back to life but remained unconscious. Months later, once she had recovered, she met her rescuers, Steve, Scott and Gary.
Her first words were pointing at Gary and saying that she recognised him. And then pointing to Steve and saying, I know you. And then pointing to me and saying, I know you, but you had more hair. And at the time that we'd had the MR call with Carmel, I did have longer hair and then cut it short. So, yeah, that was a surprise. Yeah, that threw us all back. We thought, wow.
Think about that for a second. Many people that have had near-death experiences describe the operation, the doctor, the nurse said this, the instrument looked like that. I saw my grandfather crying in the hallway praying. And these are the three EMTs that brought this woman back to life through 45 minutes. 45 minutes of compression of the heart and mouth-to-mouth, or at least breathing with a device. And she, remember, she was unconscious the whole time. She meets them after the fact, and what does she do? She describes the way the guy looked that day. And, of course, in this video, you can't see it because it's radio. He is clean-shaven. His head is clean-shaven. But he actually had long hair at the time. Now, think about that. How many times, when you add up all of these stories, will you eventually say to yourself, man, you have got to wonder how that dead, quote-unquote, person perceived the ambulance ride, or the EMTs, or the doctors talking, or seeing dust on top of a light, and we'll get to that in a little while, with somebody else. You know, in other words, you float above your body, you look down, and you see a cockroach at the, you know, in the ceiling of the, and things that are verifiable. There are stories of people floating and going down the hallway, going outside the building they were at, and seeing a sneaker on the floor, and then later on it was verifiable. There are verifiable things that these people that are technically dead state out loud. How does that happen?
I don't think it's crazy. Wouldn't it be nice when science can actually catch up? And, you know, but is it meant to be proved?
There are all kinds. We've already
attempting to prove it is the job of Dr. Sampania.
From a scientific perspective, we have to accept that these experiences occur. There are millions of cases out there, and it would be unscientific just to reject them.
Here at New York's Stony Brook Hospital, this medical scientist is collecting evidence that consciousness can live on once the brain dies.
Although the person is in fact dead and the brain doesn't function and the heart doesn't function, but the cells inside the brain are still in a potentially viable state. They're almost hibernating.
25 hospitals in Europe and the United States are participating in Dr. Pania's research.
After we die, based on the evidence that we have so far, that entity that makes me into who I am doesn't become annihilated. Does it continue tomorrow or the day after? I don't know. But certainly the first few hours after we die, during that phase when death is reversible, there is no evidence that it's annihilated. It's
okay, now think about that for a second. Maybe, and again, you know, with Shermer and other people saying it's a dying brain, well, what if the brain takes a couple hours to die? What if the experience, you know, no more heart rate, lack of oxygen, but it's not like the brain dies like that. Maybe it dies slowly. And maybe those experiences are brought on by a slowly dying brain. You know, I want to be fair on both sides of this argument. And that's what he's saying. Let me go back and just play that segment just real quick for you. Here we go.
And you tomorrow or the day after, I don't know. But certainly the first few hours after we die, during that phase when death is reversible, there is no evidence that it's annihilated. It's also important, though, to realize that...
Say that again. For a couple hours during what we now call death, you're done, toe tagged, maybe the brain cells are still operating. And maybe that experience is still taking place. And that's what he's saying there.
The interpretation of the experience depends on a person's background. So, for instance, if a Hindu in India has a near-death experience and sees a being of light, then they will interpret that potentially as being Krishna or one of the Hindu deities. Whereas if somebody, say, in Australia, who's a Christian, or in America, who's a Christian, has an experience, they may perceive that they saw Jesus.
One of their tests of whether out-of-body experiences really happen is to place photos, like this butterfly, high above critically ill patients on the operating table.
Now, this is being done worldwide by IONS and a lot of other studies. Basically, a lot of people will say they float outside their body. Well, if you're on an operating table and you float above your body, then what are you doing? You're looking down on the surgeons and what you would say your body is. Well, if you're looking down, then you're going to see that whole room. Well, what they're doing now is they're starting to place little images on top of lights. In other words, at the top of a ceiling fan. Well, you won't have a ceiling fan in an operating room, but you understand what I'm talking about is they're putting images and wondering whether that cardiac person that had the arrest, when they go back and interview them, is going, you know, I was floating above my body, And I saw the doctor, and I saw them giving me CPR and trying to resuscitate me. And then I saw on top of a ledge, no pun intended, a picture of a butterfly. So they're starting to plant evidence, hoping or wondering if those people will report that after the fact. That's what they're talking about there.
And the idea is very simple. If we get a group of people who come back and claim to have seen us, we want to know whether they also see the images as well.
It was one vivid image seen by Dr. Alexander that finally convinced him that what he'd experienced was real.
There was a beautiful girl beside me on the butterfly wing. I can remember her face so perfectly, these sparkling blue eyes and light brown hair and this loving smile. And she never said a word, but her thoughts went right into me.
Okay, this is important. I'm going to set this up. Now, remember the story of Colton? If you've ever seen the movie Heaven is for Real, Colton was had an appendix burst, and he met a young girl when he had his NDE, and he describes that to his parents, and I think he even says the name in the movie. I'm not sure. Well, it turns out his mom had a miscarriage, and she lost a girl, but Colton never was told about that. Now, think about that. How does this kid know? How does he meet someone he didn't even know existed and can verify it after the fact? Well, the same thing happened to Mr. Alexander.
You are loved. You are cherished dearly forever. There's nothing to fear. I knew her face so well, but I'd never met her in my life.
This is the woman Eben saw. Her name is Betsy. After Eben was adopted, his biological parents went on to have more children, including Betsy. She died in 1998. They never met, and it was only after his coma that the family sent him this photo.
It blows my mind. This guy's adopted into another family, but his mom and dad, his original biological mom and dad, had another kid. He never knew he had a sister. He never knew what she looked like. Never knew her name. He has an NDE, and he sees her. She never said anything to me, but he describes her. And his biological parents send him a picture of his dead sister. And he's like, that's her. That's the one I saw. How is that explainable?
And it was the very same girl who had been on the butterfly wing. And her face in the picture was almost mocking me, like, do you finally get it?
People want to believe. They want to think there's an afterlife, everything's going to be great, Michael everybody Shermer. Loves you, all justice will be served, everything will be made right in the end. I mean, who wouldn't want to believe that? I would like to believe, but what's more important for me is what's actually true.
And by the way, buy my magazine. I would like to think, you know what? I'm going to take that back. Skepticism needs to be part of this conversation. And Michael Shermer is, see, a skeptic to me, see, a cynic is, you reject everything. And to me, he's more of a cynic. Instead of saying, you know what? As more of the evidence comes in, and more of these studies and the compilation of the scientific studies, you know, we have 4,000 people talking about things. Here's what they've said. Here's some of the verifiable things, like he just said. Mr. Shermer, if he was truly a skeptic, would say, I got to leave a sliver of my doubt open to possibilities. That's a skeptic. But this man makes several hundred thousand dollars a year by selling Skeptic magazine. Just like anybody who sells a book about near-death experiences, Shermer makes a good amount of coin by discounting these things. Always remember that. I'm not saying he's wrong. I'm not saying I'm right. I am saying understand, well, follow the money, I guess is the best way to say that.
I saw
things I couldn't understand, couldn't explain, and I figured someday there would be a brain-based scientific explanation. Now I know there's a much easier, simpler, more straightforward explanation. That is that our soul is eternal, that our spirit lives forever.
Evan Alexander had meningitis. He's a neurosurgeon. Imagine thinking, going through, I don't know, what is that? At least 8 years of medical school to sit there and go, okay, this is the way the neurons fire. This is the way the brain cells work. This is the way my experiences all gathered and... It culminates in my experience because my brain process is all of this. Versus the idea that my brain is the processor of my experience, but where does that experience take place? And that's why I love that phrase, where's the movie screen where my hearing, my taste, my touch, my eyesight. What am I leaving out? Taste, touch. Leave one of those senses out. Where does that all gather together and show up in my brain? Science can't tell you. It literally can't tell you. It can't. And that's what's fascinating to me is what is consciousness? When you get into using words like soul and God, people are going to run with it. People are going to think you're religious. And if you are, fine. You know, follow your religion. Live your life. I'm not here to tell you you're right or wrong. But it is my job to ask questions. That's what I do. The next story is a little long-winded. And it's not about an NDE. It's about a surgeon. I don't know if I'm going to go through all this. I might jump through this. This is a heart surgeon, Dr. Lloyd Rudy. He's going to give you the story of one person, and it takes a little while for him to build that story up, so forgive his long-windedness. I actually edited this today, tried to take his long pauses out of it. But this is not an NDE person. This is a doctor. Again, if you notice Dr. Moody, Dr. Morse, Dr. Ring, Dr. Long, Dr. Rawlings, Dr. Lawrence, Dr. Winery, Dr. Alexander... I am trying to find a way where science can meet what we would call metaphysics or quantum mechanics or spirituality. And we're going to get into the life review in a little while because I think this is the most vital part to me anyway, what it means to me. And by the way, let me mention the word sin. You like sex? Good for you. Hurting anybody? Lying to anybody? And do what you need to do. Do who you need to do. The whole idea that people talk, when I talk about this stuff, people have a tendency to think about their own personal life. Oh, Jesus, is this a sin? And you know, no. I'm not saying it's not. I'm not saying it is. I'm saying that we have been so preconditioned to believe that this is right and this is wrong. What if your whole life experience is simply that? Up, down, right, wrong. People that can't come to this conversation think that there's somehow a damnation or a judgment or all these things that they've been told is, especially sex. Especially sex when it comes to organized religion. And sex is just part of being a human being. Gay, straight, bi, all those things. Sin. This is wrong. This offends. This is damnation. All the dirtiness of life versus the natural being of being. Have you noticed all of the people that described this thing said no judgment, no judgment, no judgment, no judgment? They didn't say, oh, you know, I found out that, you know, touching this or sucking that or this is right and this is wrong. No one said that. In all the books I read, not one person ever said they were judged. Like, this shouldn't be done, and that's wrong. All they were asked was, how did you feel? How did you treat people? What did it feel like? Did you learn? If you could go back and change things, would you? What would you change? In other words, that light was more of a teacher than a judge. It was more of a parental figure than a judge with a gavel condemning a behavior. And the reason I want to bring that up is because having been raised Roman Catholic, I was like, that makes more sense to me through the experience of living. But everyone who's religious right now that might be listening to me, oh, well, you know, you're just saying that, you know, you can do anything you want willy-nilly. You know what? Prove me wrong. The whole idea that you've been told what you are, where you are, when you are, what you should be, what you can't be by a bunch of other humans who are just as flawed as you and I, maybe it's time to call that shit out. And that's why I wrote the word sin down during the middle of that. Because so many people that are afraid of this conversation are like, well, then if you say there's a God, then I might want to, you know, be curious or an essence or a permanence or, you know, a pantheist view or a Taoist view of things. Well, you know, what if I was a polyamorous or what if I was a swinger? You know what? In the large scheme of things, do you think that being, whatever it is, if it exists, gives a shit about you having two bed partners at the same time? The concept of sin has been distorted, twisted, torqued, and fucked with. And you know, if you notice when I started this, have you hurt anybody? Have you intentionally hurt people? To me, that's what that light or that being or that essence would ask you. It wouldn't say, well, you shouldn't have done this because. So understand, so many things you've been told you are just passed down through generations of dogmatic religions and organized religions. I'm not saying there's not some truth interwoven in those things. I'm not saying there's not some decent moralistic behavior. And I don't mean, see, the word moralistic, that's a dangerous word. Think about intent versus behaviors. Move the intent to a good place. And live your life. And I guess for the lack of a better phrase, get your kink on. Just don't lie. Don't cheat. Don't hurt. Because to me, anyways, in my own personal understandings of what's going on, those would be the things that would be brought up in that conversation during a life review, and we'll get to that in a little while. Those are the things that you might want to reconsider. But when it comes to your own humanistic behaviors, you're a human being. You have feelings, you have urges. Should you act on all of them? Probably not. Should you decide? Probably more consciously through that process. Of course, we all are given those opportunities. That's what they, you know, that's what's called free will. But the whole idea of offending, imagine being this entity that, if it exists, could will a universe into existence. Do you think it cares whether you touch your dick? I wanted to mention that. I don't want to talk too much about sin. I don't want to get into this big preacher mode here. But it's very important that you understand that. When I bring this up, people always think that, oh, geez, here we go. Now it's going to be about, you know, what I did and what I didn't do and what I should have done. No. I just think you should have good intentions. Dr. Lloyd Rudy, heart surgeon. He's a little long-winded. I might skip and jump through this, but I'm going to let this roll for a couple minutes. Here we go.
Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Belligan. I'm here with Dr. Lloyd Rudy, one of the most famous cardiac surgeons. Dr. Rudy, thanks so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
You know, we don't get the opportunity to be in the operating room, or even most people don't get the opportunity to visit with a cardiac surgeon who has had experiences with people near death or some who have already been pronounced dead and come back. And so that's what we're going to talk about here, in particular one case, and may touch on another one. Dr. Rudy, why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
We had a very unfortunate individual who on Christmas Day had, from an oral infection,
okay,
infected his native valve. Okay. If your native valve has the slightest defect, so that's what happened to this man. And one of my junior partners was on call, and he had to do an emergency valve resection. Once we were able to accomplish the repair of the aneurysm and the replacement of the valve, we could not get the person off of the bypass. Make a long story short, we simply couldn't get him off the heart-lung machine.
Right.
Finally, we just had to give up. I mean, we just said, we cannot get him off of the heart-lung machine, so we're going to have to pronounce him dead.
Right.
So we did that. And so the anesthesiologist turned his machine off, and the bellows that were breathing for the patient stopped. That machine was quiet. The anesthesiologist went into the surgeon's lounge. He hadn't eaten anything all day, so he went in to have a sandwich. Then the people who usually clean up the instruments and all that were coming in and taking away all these tools. And my surgical assistant closed the patient in a way that a post-mortem exam could be done, because anyone who succumbs on the table has to, by law, has to have an autopsy.
So basically, this guy's been declared dead. They sew him with a few stitches. You'll hear him describe that here in a second. And they're basically going through the protocol of having lost a patient on the table.
Right.
So he closed him up briefly. Just a couple, three wires here and a big stitch to close his soft tissue. Well, the machine that records the blood pressure and the pulse and the left atrial pressure and all the monitoring lines and things continued to run the paper out onto the floor in a big heap. Nobody bothered to turn it off. And then we put down a transesophageal echo probe, which is just a long tube that has a microphone on the end of it, and we can get a beautiful picture on a monitor of the heart beating. Well, that machine was left on, and the tape, the VCR tape, continued to run.
Right.
Well, the assistant surgeon and I went in and took our gowns off and gloves and masks and things, and came back, and we were in our short sleeve shirts, and we were standing at the door kind of discussing if there was anything else we could have done, any other medicines we could have given, whatever,
right,
to have made this a success. And as we were standing there, it had been at least 20 minutes. You know, I don't know this exact time sequence, but it was close to 20, 25 minutes,
right,
that this man recorded no heartbeat, no blood pressure, and the echo showing no movement of the heart, just right. sitting there. And all of a sudden we looked up, and the surgical assistant had just finished closing him, and we saw some electrical activity. And pretty soon the electrical activity turned into a heartbeat. Very slow, 30, 40 a minute. And we thought, well, that's kind of an agonal thing. And we see that occasionally, that the heart will continue to beat even though the patient can't generate a blood pressure or pump any blood.
Well, think about it. I'm not a doctor. Our bodies are simply mechanical, just like a car is mechanical or a clock is mechanical. Something's working, but 9 out of 10 things aren't working. He's so nonchalant talking about, yeah, well, you know, the heart's beating a little bit, but he's dead. We got a blood pressure. We got a heartbeat of 40 beats per minute, but he's not going anywhere. He's very nonchalant. He's very matter-factual about describing the situation.
Well, pretty soon we look and he's actually generating a pressure. No, we're not doing anything. I mean, the machines are all shut off, and we're stopped all the medicines and all that.
Right.
And so I start yelling, get anesthesia back in here and get the nurses. And to make a very long story short, without putting him back on cardiopulmonary bypass, heart and lung machine and stuff, we start giving him some medicines, and anesthesia started giving him oxygen, and pretty soon he had a blood pressure of 80, and pretty soon a blood pressure of 100, and his heart rate was now up to 100 a minute. You know, he recovered.
Now think about that. This guy's declared dead. They sew him up. They got to go through the protocols. People are in cleaning up the tools. The anesthesiologist is woofing down a sandwich. And somehow this body just goes, beep, beep, coming back to life. Check this out.
And had no neurologic deficit. And for the next...
Now, yeah, remember... No blood circulating. This is when the brain dies. No oxygen to the brain. The brain cells die. That's what happens. And he said he had no neurological deficit. This guy's been sitting on a table as a cold slab for 45 minutes. These stories are fascinating.
10 days, 2 weeks. All of us went in and were talking to him about what he experienced, if anything. And he talked about the bright light at the end of the tunnel, as I recall, and so on. But the thing that astounded me was that he described that operating room floating around and saying, I saw you and Dr. Cattaneo standing in the doorway with your arms folded talking. I didn't know where the anesthesiologist was, but he came running back in. And I saw all of these post-its sitting on this TV screen.
This is an interesting story, check this out.
And what those were any call I got, the nurse would write down who called and the phone number and stick it on the monitor, and then the next post-it would stick to that post-it, and then I'd have a string of post-its of phone calls I had to make. He described that. I mean, there's no way he could have described that before the operation because I didn't have any calls.
No.
Right?
And he's sitting on, and he's lying on the... So he must have been floating.
He was up there.
Yeah.
He described the scene, things that there is no way he knew. Right. I mean, he didn't wake up in the operating room and see all this stuff.
No.
I mean, he was out.
Right.
And was out for, I don't know, even a day or two.
Right.
While
right.
we while we recovered him in the intensive care unit.
Think about that. You're wheeled in. You're already knocked out. The anesthesiologist knocks you out. You go through this operation. You die. During this operation, the doctor's phone's ringing. The nurse is answering, saying, okay. She writes a little, okay. Next thing you know, you have this little monitor covered with good old Post-its. How does this person see that? They're dead. They're out for 2 days. Where does this observation come from? If you're not at least a little curious about this, then you have an agenda, or you have your own cognitive dissonance about what you think you are, what you've been told you are, who you need to kneel and pray to, whatever those things are. That's your indoctrination. These phenomena are not going away. Now we're going to cover this one. This is one of the most fascinating ones I've ever heard about. Because you can have your five senses. And you can say, oh, I heard the nurse say this, or I saw the doctor use a saw. What if you were blind at birth? And listen to Vicky describe what her blindness is like. I'll let her do it. She does it far better than I would. And I think we're going to hear from another skeptic in this one. That's good. I like it. She's a psychologist. Her name is Susan Blackmore. Along with her and Michael Shermer, they're pretty much the two, again, I like skepticism. But a skeptic and a cynic are two different things. And if you benefit from your skepticism, you're the same thing as someone who benefits from selling a book about it. So does your skepticism get watered down because you have a reputation and an ego to protect? And that's what I'll say about Susan. I've seen her in some documentaries, too. All right, let's check this story out. This is about Vicky. I think her name is Neurotic, I think. Neurotic? Something like that. Let's check it out.
Whilst near-death experiences change lives, they've also given some individuals extraordinary experiences that they would never have dreamt of. The most intriguing examples are of blind people becoming sighted for the first time. Vicky Neurotic had been blind from birth.
I've never seen anything, no light, no shadows, no nothing. A lot of people ask if I see black. No, I do not see black. I do not see anything at all. And in my dreams, I don't see any visual impressions. It's just taste, touch, sound, and smell, but no visual impressions of anything.
In her early 20s, Vicky was involved in a serious car accident.
The next thing I recall, I was in Harborview Medical Center and looking down at everything that was happening. And it was frightening because I'm not accustomed to see things visually because I'd never had before. And initially it was pretty scary. And then I finally recognized my wedding ring and my hair. And I thought, is this my body?
Think about this. This is a woman who's never seen herself. Blind at birth. Listen to, she's described, people say, do you see black? She goes, there is nothing reported in my brain as vision, not even blackness. In other words, her brain works on four senses, not five. The fifth one, eyesight or sight, has been 0.0 since birth. She has no reference point to anything, even her own looks. Now, the reason she recognized her wedding ring was because she has fingers and she could feel the design on her wedding ring. Therefore, she recognized it because of her touch, like Braille, the same thing.
Down there? And am I dead or what?
That's just, Think of that's just crazy.
The out-of-body experience is just another very similar
kind. This is Susan Blackmore.
In which we construct the idea that now we're out of our body looking down. And it's not such a difficult thing for the brain to do, because we have in our memories all the information to do that with.
Okay. Now, if I have an NDE and I have an out-of-body experience, I know what my hand looks like. I can recognize my knuckles. I can recognize the veins in my right hand versus and believe me, there are two different sets of veins in my hands. I would be able to go, that's my left hand, because I've seen it. But Blackmore says, oh, the reason this woman saw this is because all these memories were already, this woman doesn't have a reference point for her vision. She doesn't have any vision. This is what I like to do to skeptics, is throw it back at them. But they don't do that because it's a documentary. And again, I've said this before in tonight's show, I love a good skeptic, but not a good skeptic who has their own ideological viewpoint and their own excuse or explanation for something that they cannot prove. Listen to what she says again. I'm going to back that up. Here we go.
The tunnel, for example,
I'm sorry,
to me seems very clear how and why.
Here we go.
The out-of-body experience is just another very similar kind of illusion in which we construct the idea that now we're out of...
It's called an illusion.
...our body looking down. And it's not such a difficult thing for the brain to do, because we have in our memories all the information to do that with.
Unless you're blind.
The tunnel, for example, to me seems very clear how and why you get these dark tunnels with a bright light at the end. We know how the cells in the visual system are laid out, right from the retina in the back of the eye, right the way through the visual system to the visual cortex at the back of your brain here. There are lots of cells devoted to the middle of the visual field, what you're looking at, and very few devoted towards the outside.
Okay, she's basically talking about, I guess, what you could call tunnel vision. Put blinders on a horse. They can only see in a certain angles of vision. They can't see to the periphery. But this is a woman who has no visual reference at all. And she's never had one. She doesn't know what red looks like or green. She doesn't know what dark is or light. She has no reference point, Susan.
Now, what happens when you get into shock, when you have lack of oxygen, is all the cells start firing randomly. Now, what's that going to look like? With lots of cells devoted towards the middle and very few towards the outside, it's going to look like bright light in the middle, dark towards the outside. Now, you're nearly unconscious with your eyes shut, and this is all you can see. So it feels like going forwards through a tunnel into a bright light.
We can't bring her back. Get the crash drops.
They kept saying, we can't bring her back, we can't bring her back. And they were trying to frantically work on this thing that I discovered was my body, and I felt very detached from it. And sort of...
By the way, I have to mention that. If you think about dying, you go, oh, I don't get to be me. You know, I'm going to die. I won't be me anymore. I won't be. Many. You know what? They need to do an actual study on how many people felt complete detachment from their body. In other words, I don't care. That thing over there that I thought was me, I don't care about it. Think about that. From the moment you see your hand for the first time as an infant to the moment you die, your reference point to what you are is your body. And when you have an NDE, many of them, let me back that up just a second.
Detached from it.
Detached.
Sort of.
Detached. She felt detached.
That I discovered was my body, and I felt very detached from it. And sort of, so what? And I was thinking, you know, what are these people getting so upset about? Then I thought, I'm out of here. I can't get these people to listen to me. And as soon as I thought that, I went up through the ceiling as if it were nothing. And it was wonderful to be out there and be free, not worry about bumping into anything. And I knew where I was going. And I heard this sound of wind chimes. It was the most incredible sound that I could describe. It was from the very lowest to the very highest tones.
Majestic
As
illustrations.
I was approaching this area, there were trees and there were birds and quite a few people, but they were all like made out of light.
Okay. Trees, birds. This is a blind person who has no reference to what a bird looks like or a tree. Now, if she's lived a few years and she's climbed a tree or stood next to a branch, her hands are her reference point. Unless she's held a bird, how does she know what a bird looks like?
And I could see, and it was incredible, really beautiful. And I was overwhelmed by that experience because I couldn't really imagine what light was like. It's still a very emotional thing when I talk about this because there was a point at which I could bring forth any knowledge I wanted to have. And it was like this place was where all knowledge was.
By the way, I think she's the only one tonight to reference that. When you step outside of your body, you become, let's say you go home. And you go to home, the source. Well, the source is all knowledge, all time, all everything. And it's kind of like in my brain, my little 128 IQ and the things that I can conceive and the things that I've seen with my eyes or viewed, that's my only reference point. That, that is the culmination of, quote unquote, my knowledge. Many people that have NDEs report that when they leave their body and they go to these realms or this realm they go to, that they're kind of like plugged back into the source. And anything they want to know, they instantly know. In other words, is there life on a planet circulating, going around Sirius, the star? There's four planets there. We don't even know they exist yet. But yes, there are planets there. And yes, there is life on planet number three. I instantly know that. I think it's important to mention during the NDE process that people, and not too many people have mentioned that tonight, but from what I've read and a lot of these accounts, people say, yeah, I was plugged back into ultimate knowledge. They use that word a lot. Okay, just so you understand, that's how people talk about that.
Another thing that we understand pretty well is the emotional effects. Because under stress and with shock and lack of oxygen, you'll get a massive flood of endorphins, the brain's own morphine-like chemicals, which has the effect of taking away pain, making you feel everything's absolutely fine and how it should be, giving you a very positive attitude towards everything. So that when all this stuff's coming up, oh, there's my body dying. Well, that's fine. Wow, here's these amazing things. It's all fine. So the whole experience can be colored by that particular chemical.
I get what she's saying. That a lot of people that discount the NDE say, again, serotonin, endorphins, the brain's way of calming the dying body to make the last few seconds or minutes of your life more palatable, less scary, those type of things. But she hasn't mentioned anything about being able to see things, being plugged into knowledge. Much like Shermer, they're able to take the concept of a dying brain and say, this is all that's taking place, or a stressed brain or a stressed body or a combination of those two things, and make that their hypothesis or their theory that that's exactly what's happening. And I can understand some of that, but it does not explain how a blind woman can, since birth, who's never seen a color, shape, anything other than feeling it with her hand. So again, I like skeptics. I'm not crazy about someone who's sort of filling in the blanks, and that's what I think she's done there. But it's important in the conversation, so you got to let these people speak. That's cool.
And then I was sent back, and then I went back into my body, and it was excruciatingly painful and very heavy, and I remember feeling very sick.
Vicky's case suggests that her mind was working at a time when her brain was unable to supply her with such visual information, even if she could see.
I'm very thankful to have had this experience because it helped me in many aspects of my life, and it helped me to deal with things a lot more constructively than I might have otherwise.
Interesting story. That's why I found that one fascinating. Now, remember, 37% of NDEers have an OBE, out-of-body experience. 62% of them see a light, are engulfed in a light, are surrounded by a light, move towards a light. 52% of them mention a lost loved one or dead relative. 91% come back positively changed. Now, many people say, well, yeah, you almost died. Of course you're going to, you know, you're going to take that second lap. You know, you got a second chance at life. Of course you're going to be more positive. I get that part of it. 54% paranormal sensitivities. This is important. 58% have lost their fear of death. Now, I can't say for sure, as I've been saying all night, this is not proof of life after death. But you know what? To each individual that's had this experience, it's good enough for them. They've lost their fear of death. You heard the people early on. Well, you know, I'm not afraid to die. When I die, okay, well, whatever. Now, it might be just an entire illusion, and maybe there's nothing after the fact. Or they've been given a peek at what we truly might possibly be. Permanence, a drop of water inside that giant ocean. You've always been, you are now, you always will be, that type of concept. Then why should you fear death in any way or shape or form? And many of them, 58% said they lost their fear of death. Now, I want to mention the life review. The reason I want to mention the life review is more to combat the judgmental God, religion kind of thing. These people get a chance to view their life in a panoramic, 100% birth to NDE life, all at the same time, during a communication. I'm going to let me see, we've got Jessica, and then we're going to do Dr. Kenneth Ring describing what he feels might be the connection to the life review and what we all know is the golden rule, treat others as you would have others treat you. And this is why the NDE is important to me. Because I was raised in a religion, and I was told you're going to burn, or you're going to get punished, or there's a hell, and all these things I had to overcome as I grew. And when these people talked about sitting there looking at their life, and many people in Kenneth Ring's book stated, I was engulfed in the light. I was a piece of the light, but I was not. In other words, it's kind of like, again, you're in an ocean, but you're that individual drop of water. So you are an individual, even though you're part of the whole ocean. And that your life won't be judged. You won't be damned, but there'll be lessons learned. But you'll understand the connection to you and the next drop of water to the left of you or to the right of you. And I thought that the life review was one of the most eye-opening parts of my journey in my life. Again, I don't want to be a preacher here. I'm not trying to do that. But it is important to understand that there are interesting lesson, that's a big word, interesting concepts in the NDE that are hard to ignore. Okay? Jessica has a very upbeat life review. Let's check hers out. And here we go.
I thought that was very interesting. Perhaps the next step that I might want to mention is the life review. And I did not expect there would be a life review. It just appeared. I could have a sense that there was a presence to my, you might say, over here, right, or presence over here to my left. There was like the angel or presence, something that was very, very loving, even though that space is just forever and ever. But there is a review. I've heard people say it's like an amphitheater, and you are watching this life review. Very much it was that way, which is shown before you with all color information of what you did from the moment you were born to the moment that you died. It's all simultaneous. And you know it all simultaneously. Within it, there was absolutely no judgment, just for me to watch it and to observe. And as I watched my life, what I would like to share as far as illumination or revelation was that I had made some choices that I could have made better in my life, things that I could have enjoyed more rather than so giving to other people or other situations, that I could have chosen more choices for Jessica and Jessica's joy and Jessica's purpose and what Jessica could have used her talents for herself more. Oh, that, you know, that would have been, life could have been more joyful.
Think about this. You're in this concept of light and there's this teacher and you're looking at your life and you're no longer connected to a physical body, but you still are. You exist. You get a chance to look at your life. This light doesn't go, you should have done that, and you're an idiot, and you're bad. It says, what if you'd done this instead? What if you tried that? What if? In other words, options. Or the big phrase, free will. What if you had chosen differently? That's why this, the life review to me is so fascinating, is it really did feel like when I read these stories that this entity was a teacher, not a judge. It was the ultimate parent.
So from my passion with animals, passions with travel, passions I have for the environment, I basically, as I mentioned, had put myself to helping others to build their businesses and marketing and networking. I died at 27. So from the timeline of starting to work when you're in your 20s to 27, putting that as the major goal and the major effort, I call it my mind, my spirit, the person who, my ego, building other people up. Oh, it's, I got a joke and say, shoot, I could have had a V8. Whoa, wait a minute. What happened here in this life review? I saw that. And I was sad. I was very, in that emotion, that I did have that emotion. As I mentioned, it was the life review, and then there was a contemplation place, a place of contemplation I feel that I was sent to. Was it fast? Was it speedy? It was just instantaneous. It was in darkness. There was a sense of darkness, of being in a place, and that I was to contemplate what I had seen and experienced, and it was not pleasant. It was like, no, I could have done so much more with my life. And a lot of it was joy. I could have had so much more joy and the things I could have done. Well, let's say I had an opportunity to go to Alaska and I turned it down. An opportunity to go on this excursion. No, I think I have to work. I had an opportunity. And I remember all these different opportunities. And I need to work. I need to do this. I need to do these different things. Oh, but I could have done that. And the joy inside of me, the joy of my personality, the joy of who I am.
I just think there's something magical about the life review because, A, there's no judgment, there's no dogmatic, there's no punishment, there's no damnation, all that shit. But I also understand the opposite side of that coin is, what if you had chosen basically a teacher, the ultimate wisdom, the ultimate guide, the ultimate parent, the ultimate knowledge that kind of sat you down? What if that's what God is? What, you know, I'm not saying it exists. I'm not saying it doesn't. To me, I can't say it's real because this event didn't happen to me. But I've sitting here over 10 years of reading and studying these events and saying to myself, wow, what if permanence is what we are? What if we get to the point where we start to understand that think of how it will affect our choices. Think about how choosing love over fear. I say that all the time on my social media, that how many times that governments and politicians and religions use fear to control me versus using loving, caring, empathetic, forgiving choices to make those decisions instead. And that's why this phenomenon is so fantastic to me, is because I really do feel, and I'll get to that in the closing comments on the show, that we have a choice every day. Every day we have a choice to change things. Maybe you need to call someone up and say, I'm sorry. Maybe you need to call someone up and say, I forgive you. Maybe you need to call someone up and say, I'm going to take that job. Maybe you need to call someone up and go, I want to get in shape and not feel so sickly and overweight or whatever. Life is about choices. And I think the Life Review reminds us of that.
And I hadn't fully chosen that when I was alive. I was like, no, no. Then I'm back in front of the amphitheater and the Life Review begins again. This time, when the Life Review begins, the contemplation I have had of what I could have done and what I could have chosen for myself, the opportunities that were being very meaningful to me, of me, myself, my personality. Now, this is the life that I would have lived. And it was really nice. It was so much more fun. Like, oh, roll that tape back. Now get a brand new tape. And I thought, wow, I was just so full of joy. Like, wow, Earth was so much more fun. The people, the things that I was doing, people I was meeting. Like, wow, it's so much fun. And playing with animals, going to the beach, going to these different travelings, going on cruises, believing in myself, pulling in money in ways that I would love and that I would enjoy. Just laughing, hiking to the top of the mountain, seeing how gorgeous the ocean was, just taking time for myself. I'm living it. It's like, wow, this is great. This is great. I'm just, oh, this is so cool. Okay, this is it. Send me back. I want to go back. This is it. I'm going back.
Think about that. Now, some people call that regret. I wish I'd done this and hadn't done that. If I had it to do over again. How many times have you said that? I know I have. I know many people have. What if you had a near-death experience and somehow ended up in this realm, and you're sitting in this thing called a Life Review, and you're shown not only your life that you were, but the life you could have been? How cool is that? There is something, I don't know. These stories fascinate me. And the reason they do is because of possibilities. You know, I almost did a show called Possibilities. You hear that? Yeah, the windows are open. So gorgeous out. Got airplanes flying by out on the Ledge Studios here. We're going to get to one more NDE life. I'm sorry, Dr. Kenneth Ring describing what I found is, and I remember reading this in his book, but this was him during an interview. Dr. Kenneth Ring wrote a book, and I don't like to use the word Bible, but I still have his book. It's called Lessons from the Light. And it changed me. It didn't confirm that there is more, but it definitely opened the possibility that there is to me. I can't prove it to you. I can't scientifically put it in front of you and go, this is it. It's real. Take it. I can't do that. But maybe 10 years from now, we'll be able to. Maybe we'll have another 10,000 or 100,000 stories of people going, you know what? This was real. And then we'll compile that evidence. And it maybe will meet quantum mechanics and quantum physics and metaphysics in the middle. And we'll realize that there's a metaphysical, in other words, there's a three-dimensional universe we live in, which we'll call the physical universe, versus something else. And they are the same thing. the experience on one side of the veil versus the other. What is the reality? Yeah, this is a red pill, blue pill. What is the reality? What is the illusion? Now, for many people on planet Earth, this is the reality. But these stories tend to lean in the other direction as this is the illusion and the reality is the opposite side of that veil. Again, I can't prove this to you. That's what this show is about tonight. Show is about this phenomenon and the doctors and the studies and the actual people trying desperately to use words, which are very limited, to describe this phenomenon that took place in their world. Dr. Kenneth Ring's little 3-minute version of the Life Review. I've sent this video to many people. And let me see, I've probably sent it 50 times in the last 10 years, and I've had one or two people answer back. And I don't know if that's because of guilt, and people will look at their own choices in the mirror and realize that they kind of did people wrong or screwed somebody over or mean or hateful or vicious or physically abusive and all the way down the line. It's never been why I sent it out. It was simply to say, what if you had a chance to view your life from two perspectives? The golden rule. Now, Christianity says what, you know, Jesus, the legend of Jesus says, what I do unto you, what I do to you, I do to myself. In other words, my right hand would simply be chopping my left hand off. If I were to be violent to you, I'd be hurting myself. And many people just shun that and go, eh, whatever. Now think about this. What if we are all quantumly connected? Because right now, the same atoms that are in my body are connected to the same atoms in the oxygen in the air in this room, and that can reach all the way to you and your skin. In other words, there's no such thing as separation. The separation is the illusion. The reality is we are all one. So what I do to you, I do to me. And many religions reflect this. Listen to this story.
I think this is one of the most remarkable aspects of a near-death experience, and it's one that's not really given the amount of attention that it should. Obviously, many people know about the light, they know about the out-of-body experience, but the thing that really is, I think, important about the near-death experience and in regard to the life review phenomenon is it isn't just a life review. It's a reliving of your life. And when people describe this, it's not always done in this way, but when people describe the full experience, it's every single act that you have done, every single thought that you have thought, every single word that you have spoken, suddenly all of this is back with you. You are running through it again, and as you say, you see and you experience the effects of these acts, these thoughts, and these words on other people. Let me just give you one brief example to illustrate this. I have a friend who had who, when growing up, was kind of a roughneck. He had a hot temper, and he was always getting into scrapes. And one day, he was driving in his truck through the suburb in the town where he lived, and he almost hit a pedestrian. And he got very aggravated at this pedestrian, and he was a very big physical guy, still is. And a fight ensued, and he punched this guy out and left him unconscious on the pavement, got back into his truck, and roared off. 15 years later, this guy has a near-death experience.
What do you think happens here? Think about what I just said. How you treat others is how you treat yourself. Most major religions have some type of reference to this. What you do unto others, you do to me. It's a very famous phrase. What if the quantum field of science and the metaphysics that say we are all the same atoms, you know, my atoms are made up of carbon and iron and stuff from exploding stars, and you and I are made up of the same things, and these atoms have been around for billions of years. Every time a star explodes, it creates more of these heavy elements. These heavy elements happen to be what I'm made of. So are you. So you and I are made of the same stardust. Like Crosby, Stills, and Nash. We are stardust. We are golden. What if the science and the spirituality, I'll use that term, actually say that? Check this out. This could be life-changing for a lot of people. I know I haven't had a near-death experience, but when I heard their stories and I realized that, you know what, I'll give you a thought after we're done with this.
Oddly enough, it was caused by an accident in regard to his own truck at that time. But in any event, he has a near-death experience, and during the near-death experience, he has a life review. And in his life review, this particular scene where of the fight takes place again, comes up in his life review. And he said that, as many people do, he kind of experienced this from a dual aspect. There was a part of him that was almost as if he were high up in a building, looking through a window and seeing the fight below. But at the same time he was observing the fight like a spectator, he found himself in the fight, except this time he found himself in the role of the other person. And he felt all 32 blows that he had rained on this person originally 15 years ago, now being inflicted upon himself.
That's heavy. That is heavy. If I were to yell at you, cheat on you, hurt you, burn you, literally physically abuse you, and I have this phenomenon take place in my life, and I go to this thing called a life review, not only do I see my actions from my birth to my drowning or whatever, now I'm realizing in this experience that the things I've inflicted on you, I'm going to have to feel. Now, see, people that want justice, and why does God let these things happen, and why is there no judgment? Well, this isn't a judgment. This is a balancing of the effects of karma. And you get to experience it, I can't say in real time, because time doesn't take place during these things. But think about that. I just want to back it up again so you can sit there and say, okay, this man had what?
And he felt all 32 blows that he had rained on this person originally 15 years ago, now being inflicted upon himself. He felt his teeth cracking. He felt the blood in his teeth. He felt everything that this other person must have felt at that particular time. It was a complete role reversal, an empathic life review experience. And this is the sort of thing that many people report. And when they report these kinds of experiences, they realize that in our life, we are the very people that we hurt. We are the very people that we help to feel good. And we experience these actions as though done to ourselves in the life review. So that when people start talking about the golden rule in the context of the near-death experience, the golden rule is not just a precept for moral conduct, it's the way it works. And you experience this during the life review. And you learn that lesson in a very forcible way as a result of going through this kind of experience. And that's why when people have NDEs, they change as much as they do. Because if you can even imagine what it must be like to go through your entire life and see everything that you've ever done without judgment, but from a kind of almost omniscient point of view with regard to the effects of those actions, and see what your actions do to other people, it's a heavy kind of lesson, and it's something that stays with you, and it informs your conduct for the time after your near-death experience.
Now think about that. If I, 20 years ago, got in a, let's say it didn't even get physical, let's just say it was a screaming war with an ex, and I said vicious, mean, nasty things to that person, because I was hating, I was egotistical, I was brutal, I was angry, and I was hurting, and I inflicted my venom that I was feeling back on that person. In this life review, I feel what they felt as those nasty words were coming out of my mouth and hurting them. I feel exactly what they felt. You want judgment, and you want balance, you want accountability in this universe and this God reference and all these things. What better teacher is it than you go through what you've caused. That's fantastic. I'm not saying I'm looking forward to this if this takes place when I die, but I'm saying, you know what? What better teacher would that be in my realm than to teach me? And by the way, this is the vicious part of it. You also get the good part of it. You know, today, right up the street, I went to go get a Red Bull. I opened the door for a woman on the way out. And a lot of times you open the door for someone and then just walk in like you're the door attendant. This woman said, "Thank you, sir. Happy Thanksgiving." And I was like, right back at you. Think about this. The more you are nice and loving and supportive and you prop the world up with good intentions, you'll get to feel that too. I don't want to be heavy in this because there's both sides. It's all about choice, choice and consequence. I'll let him finish.
So it does give us a lot to think about. And that's why I say in my book, Lessons from the Light, the near-death experience isn't given just to those who have the experience. It's given to all of us to learn from, because all of us can profit by the lessons that near-death experiences learn in the course of a life review or other aspects of their experience. And we can grow from these lessons, and we can apply these lessons into our daily life.
We're all going to have regret. None of us are perfect. We're all going to fuck it up from time to time. We're all going to make stupid mistakes. We're all going to make egotistical decisions. We're all going to make selfish choices. Granted. But we're also going to do the opposite. We're also going to do loving, caring, giving, unselfish acts. What would you prefer your life review be? What would you like to experience all over again? I'm not a preacher. This isn't about your judgment. This isn't about some God. Tonight has been about the possibility that your consciousness, that your existence, that your very essence might be permanent. And I mean, it's been there, it is now, and it always will be. And that's how I view my world. People say, "Ledge, why do you say the things you do, and why do you believe the things you do?" And I go, because in my concept of what I am, I'm a permanent piece of consciousness on the Scott ride. And Scott has choices every moment, every day in his life. And he can act selfish, act lazy, act vengeful, jealous, envious, or he can do the opposite, relish every day, try to smile, try to bring just something positive into someone's life, whether it's your family or your loved ones. Maybe it's you have to be patient with an old grandfather. Maybe you get into political discussions and have to bite your tongue. Whatever it is, according to tonight's show, you might have to view that again and feel it. Not just watch it like in a movie, but feel it from your perspective again, and then feel it from somebody else's. So for the last 15 years of my life, I've had a different concept of what I might be. And it has changed me. And to be honest with you, it's given me some fucking hope. I'm not saying it proved anything. I'm not saying it scientifically can demonstrate what I am or who you are. But you know what I'm saying? It's fascinating. And I mean fascinating. I hope this last 3 hours were thought-provoking. At least. You know? Where maybe somewhere, I'm not saying reject what you believe. I'm not saying, you know, put your book down and never look at it again, whatever it is, or your concepts, or your constructs. That's your journey. It's special. It's unique to you. Be who you need to be. But I am saying this. What if? That's always what I've been about. That's always what this show has been about. It's never been, you're this, I'm that. It's never been in stone. I've spent the last 17 years of my life being flexible. I am really glad that doctors and researchers and people that claim to have experienced this are speaking out. I don't know if it proves anything, but I'll tell you what, it's a little mind-boggling, and also at the same time, it is, like I said, it gives me hope. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's show. I told you when I started doing DC again that I would, and tonight the 8-year-old in my brain took the night off. There's a little sophomoric part of me. There's a playful part of me. There's the reckless part of me. There's the exploratory part of my consciousness and experiences that I will never deny. And then there's things like this that I just can't prove, but I'm not going to reject it. I'm going to let it be part of what I am. And I'm not going to let it guide me, but I am going to let it suggest to me that, you know what? If when I croak and if I have this type of experience, I want that life review to feel awesome for the most part. You guys have a great night. It's been, It's been the reason I do this show. It's been, and I appreciate your patience, and, you know, reject it. I don't give a shit. The last 3 hours of bullshit to you, and then go do your thing. You're perfectly entitled, and I won't tell you you're wrong. But I will say this. If you can keep an open mind, maybe in the next 10, 50, 100 years, maybe our species will have a greater understanding of what we possibly might be. And maybe someday there'll be a definitive scientific proof to what everything I talked about tonight. Or not. Maybe we're just a conglomeration of atoms that happened because a singularity exploded 13.5 billion years ago, and I'm full of shit. Or maybe not. You guys have a good one. Good night.
This is a Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
You look at Sandy Hook. He was not an Islamic, radical Islamic guy. He was a red-blooded American who was cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs, but he bought his guns legally. You look at the shooting in Colorado at the abortion clinic. He was not a radical Islamic. He bought his guns legally, but he was cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. So it's not the guns. In fact, your Democratic running mate, who you have now endorsed, Hillary Clinton, said today that we have to make it impossible for terrorists to get their hands on these assault rifles. Oh, I get it. I agree. But she was basically saying that no one should be able to get their hands on these assault rifles and these type of weapons. Well, that's not true. And I had this conversation with someone at work who said the same thing. Why are gun stores allowed to sell these weapons? Who needs those? Who needs those? And my words to him, and luckily another military person was there with me, said, you'd be surprised how many people actually have AR-15s in their house or may ride around with them in their car. But they don't go around shooting 50 people because, again, it's their God-given right as a U.S. citizen to carry those weapons. So it's not the weapons. It's not, we can't use the term weapon of mass destruction. Because think about this logically. This guy in Orlando wanted to do this. Say he couldn't get his hands on an AR-15. What would stop him from getting his hands on a Remington 870 shotgun? Or what would stop him from going to buy two or three handguns, have them fully loaded with extra magazines already loaded and extra rounds to reload at the club? He still would have taken out a few people. It would have happened if that was his agenda, to commit that act of violence for his political goal. He would have done it regardless, whether it was an AR-15, shotgun, 9mm, 40 caliber, 22, long rifle, you name it. He would have done his agenda because it was his agenda. So we can preach how we need to ban assault weapons. We need to ban this. But I'm telling you, that is not the issue.
Beyond the Badge with Vincent Hill can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and RadioInfluence.com.